Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, about the year in review and also about what's going on in D.C. A lot to talk about there. Also, first hour, State Representative Dante Santoni going to be here talking about the liquor board fight. In the second hour, Joe Markosik, State Representative, going to be here talking about the lack of leadership that the Republicans have shown here in the state, as basically they have had steamroller power. They have had the power to do whatever it is that their twisted little minds could get them to do. And you know what? They couldn't do it because they're so far out on the fringe. Their leadership is so far off the beaten path that the sane, rational Republicans are going, we can't go there with you. Sorry. Glad that we're kind of in the same party, but you're way off the deep end. So it'll be interesting to talk to the two state reps about what happened this last legislative session, because, look, a lot of the really ugly stuff missed us. All of the ugliness that you saw in Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan and Florida and Tennessee and New Jersey and Maine, you name it, missed us. That has to do with a whole bunch of factors, but we'll get to talk to them about their thoughts. Also in the second hour, Justin Feldman. He is the work health and safety advocate for Public Citizen and their Congress Watch division. He's here talking about child labor, looking into the new year as Republican presidential candidate Newt Gingrich seems to have brought that to the forefront that, you know, to him, children not operating heavy machinery, truly stupid in his mind. And in the third hour, David Levine, assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, going to be here talking about the two internet bills working their way through Congress and their piece, Don't Break the Internet. I told you where I stand on those. I think they're bad pieces of legislation. I think they will never be able to accomplish what it is that they're aiming to do, but what they will do is they will stifle free speech and they will destroy the inner tubes as we know it. And basically, you'll destroy that whole industry. What will happen is all those servers and all that stuff will go offshore, and you're still not going to be able to regulate what goes on. So, you know, good luck trying that. Not going to happen. But it's interesting to talk to David Levin about that in the third hour. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So this is going to be our last program of the 2011 year. We are taking a much-needed, much-deserved, break to spend time with our families over the holiday season, do maybe a little bit of traveling, a little bit of this or that, and we will be back next year, rip-raring to go, and hopefully you have a wonderful holiday as well. I don't know if you saw it. But today you have Speaker Pro Tem Michael Fitzpatrick, a nice Republican here from Pennsylvania, came in, took the Speaker's gavel, they said the pledge, and then they dismissed. Don't you just hate when technology bites you in the behind and you don't plug the right cord in? Anyway, he gavels in, and they say the almighty pledge.
Three, the House stands adjourned until 10 a.m. on Friday.
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker. I'd like to ask for unanimous consent that we bring up the bill to extend the tax cut for 160 million Americans. As you walk off the floor, Mr. Speaker, you're walking out. You're walking away, just as so many Republicans have walked away from middle-class taxpayers, the unemployed, and very frankly as well from those who will be seeking medical assistance from their doctors, 48 million senior citizens. We regret, Mr. Speaker, that you have walked off the platform without addressing the issue of critical importance to this country, and that is the continuation of the middle-class tax cut, the continuation of unemployment benefits for those at risk of losing them, and the continuation of the access to doctors for all those 48 million seniors who rely on them daily for their health. And I am pleased to yield to my friend, Mr. Van Hollen.
You know, you listen to that, and, the Republicans came in, they said their pledge, they gaveled out, and they left. What happened to the up or down vote? Does anybody remember that? I remember during the Bush years, I heard Republicans griping about it constantly. Up or down vote, up or down vote. Where's the up or down vote? And I got to be honest, the Republicans are taking a beating, and they should over this. The reality is if we don't pass the extension of the unemployment, you could see more than 3 million people getting booted off the unemployment rolls. And, that may sound all fine, well, and good, but what's it going to do to our economy? And the other thing that they want to do, they want to cut the number of weeks of benefits, basically kicking more people off. The idea here is that in their mind is to make it so painful that people take under the table jobs or do whatever it is they can do to subvert the economy and get away from. My mind is about to explode over this. When you start and you look at by the end of March, they estimate 3.6 million people could be booted off of unemployment. 3.6 million people who are spending money in our economy. And I was reading a story in the Wall Street Journal today. And the Republicans love talking about, how businesses aren't going to create jobs because of the uncertainty. Oh, Mr. President, you're making everybody uncertain. Well, this is making people uncertain. And the Republicans are saying, well, it's a small amount of money. To them, it's a small amount of money. To someone who makes $400 a week, that $20 in their paycheck, that means a lot. That means whether they have gas in their tank or food on the table. And this is kind of one of those moments where you go, there is a massive disconnect in this country between the wealth class, of which most of our representatives are members of, and everybody else. Where you say, well, 2% of $50,000 a year, that's only $1,000 a year. Well, what's $1,000? It's not going to really do much. Yes, it will. When you're talking about 160 million people, when you're talking about the number of people and the amount of demand and the amount of money you're pulling out of the economy, that is going to kill small business. And, like as one of the employers in the article that the Wall Street Journal said, when all of your employees look at their paychecks and it is now 2% less than it was last week, they turn to look at you and go, where's the rest of my money? And, I go back to when this tax cut happened. And, more than half of the people didn't even know they got a tax cut. It was just in their checks and they were just consuming it and they were just using it and it was in the economy. Now when you take that away, what's that going to do to our economy? And now the Republicans understand, and I do believe the calculus, the tea leaves are, that if they pull this back out, if they continue to create this uncertainty, no jobs will be created. If you pull the money out of the economy, you'll see some slowdown. So even the modest growth that has happened over the last two years, That's going to stop. And you will probably see that reverse a little bit. Now, I'm hoping, you know, we talked with David Madeline the other night, we talked to Michael Linden the other night from the Center for American Progress, and he said, look, there's a very real possibility of a double dip here if this doesn't happen. It's more than just the 2% payroll tax. It's the unemployment. It's the money for the doctors. There's a lot to this that could really hinder our ability to continue the recovery. And if you look at the numbers, the Labor Department just came out with some new numbers. 43 states in November. 43 states saw their unemployment rates drop. And in three other states, they reported, you know, modest, small increases. Four others were completely unchanged. But 43 states, it got better. Not amazingly better, but moving in the right direction. You pull those resources out of the economy, you pull back on the reins, you begin to slow down the modest recovery that's been going on, and what do you end up with? And I truly think that the Republicans have seriously overplayed their hand on this. Boehner has allowed the Tea Party people to control him instead of him being the Speaker of the House. And you know, you go back and you go, when he first took the gavel, you know he had in his heart of hearts that he was going to be the next Tom DeLay. He was going to be the hammer. He was going to keep people in line. He was going to run a tight ship. They have twisted him every which way possible. They've bent him in every direction. They've bent him over. They've bent him backwards, and they've bent him over again. And for what? Nothing has gotten done. Nothing. And I go back to the laser-like focus. What happened to the jobs, jobs, jobs? All we get out of them is more tax cuts for the wealthy. And now this could be a tax increase on the rest of us. You got to love that. I don't know. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Also, take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
The better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says House Republicans need to decide whether they stand with the wealthiest 1% or they can come to their senses and stand for working people and pay attention to the jobs crisis. The Labor Federation is calling on House Speaker Boehner to lead his caucus to pass the bipartisan Senate bill that would extend jobless benefits and the payroll tax break working families need. The AFL-CIO says it's a modest compromise that would help millions of families. Senate Republicans are afraid that President Obama will use his recess appointment powers to seat nominees to the National Labor Relations Board. Republicans are blocking the nominations because they don't want a functioning labor board protecting workers' rights. All 47 GOP senators signed a letter warning Obama not to make the appointments. According to a report by Good Jobs First, states are spending billions of dollars each year on corporate tax credits, cash grants, and other taxpayer economic subsidies that require little or no job creation from those companies in return. The report, Money for Something, rates the performance standards and job quality requirements of 238 key subsidy programs from the 50 states and the District of Columbia. Together, they cost more than $11 billion a year. This corporate tax welfare spends tax dollars without gaining any good jobs for the states in return. Good Jobs First Executive Director Greg LeRoy says with joblessness still so high, taxpayers have a right to expect that economic development investments of tax dollars create significant numbers of high-quality jobs. The full report is available at goodjobsfirst.org. 200 workers have lost their jobs at a big foundry due to a sweep by the Office of Homeland Security, Jesse Russell reports.
The country's third largest foundry is letting go of 200 workers. The Office of Homeland Security did a sweep of the Pacific Steel Foundry, seeking workers who couldn't provide a valid Social Security number. One-third of the employees couldn't do so, and only a handful were able to produce new documents clarifying their legal status. The layoffs come as the company has been seeing an uptick in demand. Since the start of this year, 130 workers have been added at the plant, which pays an average of $18 per hour. Many of the laid-off workers had been employed at the factory for more than two decades.
A strike at Charles de Gaulle Airport in France is entering its sixth day this morning. The strike was launched by workers seeking an increase in pay. The Civil Aviation Authority said it plans to bring in replacement workers to help lighten the impact of the strike on holiday travelers. This newscast made possible in part by ULICO, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, and OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast from the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and you can take the program on the go. So, you know, a lot of questions around what's going on here in Pennsylvania this last year, as a lot of states around the nation have been hit by the radical right wing. And pretty much, you know, you look at Wisconsin, the right-wing agenda sailed through. You look at Ohio, the right-wing agenda sailed through. Florida, Michigan, you name it. The Republicans in those other states drank the Kool-Aid and followed the ALEC marching orders, followed the billionaire marching orders. But somehow here in Pennsylvania, put a little bit of the brakes on. We didn't get a lot of the ugliness. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's maybe a handful of sane, rational Republicans left in that party that hasn't taken them completely off the deep end. But anyway, here to talk to us about the year in review and how it stopped here, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Irwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick. How you doing? Happy New Year. Merry Christmas to all our listeners, and happy Hanukkah to those of us who celebrate with me. And today was the first full day of Hanukkah and the second light on of the eight nights. And it's good to be here tonight.
It's great having you. And I, again, wish you and your family the best in this holiday season.
Thank you.
Let's get to it. You know, as you look across the country, as I said in the beginning, we've seen a lot of ugliness. Here, maybe not so much.
Well, we've seen a lot of attempted ugliness here. It's just that in Pennsylvania, we were able to, A, avoid some of the most ugly of the ugliness, and B, to beat back some of the modestly, but only modestly, less ugly proposals that the, you know, fringe of the so-called right wing or conservative, they like to call themselves conservatives, but they don't really stand for conserving anything, they stand for destroying anything. We've been able to beat it back, and I think that that's truly a testament to the wonderful, extraordinary hard work that working people have done in Pennsylvania to let their political elected officials know that this is not Wisconsin, this is not Michigan, this is not Ohio, this is not Indiana, this is not Kentucky. This is a place where rationality prevails and where lunatics and fringe players on all ends of the spectrum are not to be the leaders. And their efforts to marginalize us have been met with our own marginalization of them.
Right. You know, but I look at this, and while we've had to fight back some of all of the insanity, what's happened is we're now another year older, and still that laser-like focus they told me that they were going to have on jobs, didn't happen. And now we're still talking about, I don't know if you saw it, Zogby, the budget guy, said $500 million in the hole, so that, in his opinion, means more cut and gut and punish. So we haven't done what we should have been doing, which is creating infrastructure jobs, creating a system that taxes the Marcellus Shale so that it benefits people, maybe closing the Delaware loophole, doing a lot of things that we should have been doing to help, you know, bring some more revenue in and help getting people back to work.
Well, you know, you hit the nail on the head, and the reports I saw from Zogby were that it's $500 million to maybe as much as $750 million. And the fact is that we all need to be honest here. And honesty in this context means that we need to listen to what these people are saying, not to what we hope they mean, because they have been painfully, brutally honest when we look at their words and measure them against their own personal history. Zogby, for example, came back to state government as the budget secretary with a zeal that he described in his confirmation hearings before the Pennsylvania Senate less than a year ago for being the hatchet man. And we also remember that this is a guy who worked for this K-12 company before coming back to state government that is all bound up in the idea of literally expropriating, if you will, confiscating, if you will, taxpayer money that had been earmarked for public schools and putting it in the hands of his K-12 company that makes a profit instead of educating children. And they do it by diverting tax dollars from public education into their own pockets. I just read a week, 10 days ago, that the principal officer in this K-12 company that until very recently employed Mr. Zogby as well, got a $5 million bonus, and their only income, 100% of their income, comes from taxes and diversion of school taxpayer money from schools to their pockets. So, you know, if we hear what they say and measure it honestly against their own histories, we learn a lot. And when they talk about things like the need to cut prevailing wage, they're not talking about that in the context of a need to save money. They're talking about that in the context of their need to reallocate money out of the pockets and of workers and out of the mouths of the families of workers and into their own pockets, even when they're getting multi-million-dollar salaries already financed by taxpayers. So
that's amazing. Well, $5 million bonus. What's his salary?
I don't even know, and understand this private company, so they don't have to reveal this. This is not subject to the antiseptic nature of sunshine. Mr. Justice Brandeis, many years ago, said that the greatest antiseptic that a government can have is sunshine, and he was so right. But these are private companies. Last week when we fought this war, and I was really blessed by being up at the Capitol, just having finished the most recent incarnation of the fight over vouchers and charters and expansion of corporate tax credit in public education. But many of the players involved opposite us in this whole fight over vouchers and charters have steadfastly and very actively opposed the idea of their companies that are all financed by taxpayer money ever being subject to ethical practices and transparency and accountability that our own school districts, from whom the money is being taken, are obligated to do as a matter of law.
Yeah, and I think that's important to continue to point out because, you know, most people like to complain about the government. They like to complain about public services. But once we privatize this stuff, who are you going to complain to then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this hue and cry that we continue to hear for privatization and deregulation, we need to understand whether it's in public education or these so-called P3s, these public-private partnerships, this is a diversion of taxpayer money to a subset, a small subset of the private sector, who would not be regulated, who would not be subject to the antiseptic nature of sunshine, who would not be accountable to us, even though they're getting our money. And while we won last week, and we've won any number of these battles with efforts to have the General Assembly use its awesome constitutional power in a fashion where they've been asked to vote to cut people's wages, to stop protecting children from exploitation at the workplace, to eliminate the pensions that people have earned over decades of work in selfless public service, to cut back access to public transportation. Nobody, Rick, nobody contemplated the General Assembly, the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, or the Pennsylvania Senate to be created and to be involved in the idea of using this awesome power that has been conferred upon them by the voters to take away from the very voters their right to oversee, manage, and have transparency and accountability about their own money, their tax dollars. Yet the people who advocate that are the ones that have the colossal gall to refer to themselves as what? Conservatives.
Yeah, I get a kick out of, you know, they complain, it's my tax dollars, we should be able, you know, they're wasting it. Exactly, they're wasting it on this privatization scheme. And one of the things, the biggest wastes, in my opinion, and I've yet to find but a handful of people who are as opposed to this EITC, this Educational Improvement Tax Credit, as I am, because, you know, For me, I look at the story, and I don't know if you've seen it. It's about a year. I think it's a year old, or maybe two. The Koch brothers gave Florida State University, I think it was like $2 million. And for that $2 million donation, they had veto power over anyone hired in the economics department. So if there was somebody in there that Florida State would want to hire who wasn't going to preach the Chicago School, you know, free market ideology, the Koch brother could say, no, we gave you the $2 million. We don't want him in there. To me, that's what this EITC thing is opening the door for, giving corporations the ability to say, here's school, we're going to give you some money, but we want a little something back, a little quid pro quo.
Well, I did see those reports, and you're absolutely right on beam. But just think it through a little bit more. If it is okay for these fringe players, the Koch brothers, these masters of corporate exploitation of people, to have a voice in who's on the faculty at Florida State University, much less veto power, what that means is that any number of others could too. So what happens when the Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda contribution comes in? Do they get to revise history altogether? Maybe they get to tell us that the Holocaust didn't happen. Maybe they get to tell us that, you know, the big Satan, United States, shouldn't be allowed to do things in its own country, that we would be restricted, because this is a very, very frighteningly slippery slope. And it's bad, and I really think that it is shamefully bad, corruptive bad, that the Koch brothers got away with what they've gotten away with. Imagine the possibilities of the expansion of this that we were able to stop last week.
Yep. And, you know, going back to this EITC thing, because, again, you know, there's part of me that says, you know, the thing about them having influence is one thing. The other part of it is I don't want to pay for their philanthropy. This is a tax credit they're getting that they're not paying into the state government. I don't understand why we're asking them to give some money that we're going to give them a credit for, instead of just saying, in years past, we taxed you and we used that money to fund schools. We don't need to have this charade of you donating it and getting a tax credit that the citizens have to pick up.
No, you couldn't be any more correct. And the double-fanged approach of this is that on the one hand, they get a tax credit. It's not a deduction like our listeners get. For a part of their residential mortgage, they get a deduction. This is a credit. So if they owed a dollar in taxes and they made a dollar's worth of contributions, they get a direct credit. They don't pay the taxes,
yep.
Which means that everybody else's taxes go up. That's number one. The number two, they get this inordinate voice in the operation or administration of the target of this specialized tax treatment that's only made for rich folks. That's scary because of what it means in the immediate sense, but there is not too distant a trip from that becoming, okay, well, I'll pay a portion of the really dramatically lower than it ought to be tax bill that is imposed. imposed on me, and now I want to have a voice directly in my government, too. I don't want to have this indirect thing just where I can control the school. I want to have veto power over who gets to be the Secretary of Education or Labor and Industry or Transportation. Or I want to have veto power over who gets selected as the low responsible bidder for engaging in public work, because I want to give it to my brother-in-law.
Yep. Let me ask you the last question I've got for you. Got about a minute left. Going on the national scene, what's going on in Washington, D.C., to me is just despicable. And the Republicans, I don't know if anybody could be watching what's going on in D.C. and not realize who's on the side of the investor class. And I'm just struggling with this. Why we're fighting over extending people's unemployment and a meager little tax break for the working people of this country.
Well, it is, in a word, breathtaking. But it is also, really, in many respects, in a sad way, very good, because, again, we have a little bit of sunshine and it exposes people for what they are. We need to raise and ask the questions. How much has the corporate class paid to this small group of bomb throwers? And that's exactly what they are, throwing bombs into the future of our country. How much have they collected? This Citizens United decision that we've talked about in other contexts in the past really has an impact. And here's where it is. This is where the rubber meets the road. When political contributions are unlimited, these things get diverted, and when people tell me how they don't think elections count, understand that this is it. This is how elections count, because if I am in control of the majority party in the legislative body, I'm in control of what gets voted on and what gets stopped. The real key here is that Boehner and the wingnuts, along with people like Nudie and the Blowhards, have collectively decided that it's too dangerous for their own members to vote on legislative proposals that help people because they might actually pass. And come election day, we need to note that. And they tried this week successfully, I might add, in Pennsylvania to make our voice less valuable by coming up with these lunatic gerrymandered legislative and Senate districts and this unctuous redistricting of our 18 congressional districts into a bundle of nuttiness where they have just realigned the world for no reason, so that people who live just outside of Harrisburg are represented by a congressman from Hazleton, and people who live in Harrisburg are represented by a congressman from York. The congressman from Hazleton is actually closer physically to the New York border than he is to the suburban Harrisburg pieces of his new congressional district.
Well, that's what happens when you have a creative pen.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you not only have a creative pen, but when you have a government that is not of the people, by the people, for the people, but of the special interests of the incumbents, for the incumbents, and by the incumbents who are in the majority.
Yep.
And this was not a redistricting and reapportionment plan that they imposed on us. This is a protect the incumbents plan. So when we get back to where you started on the jobs, we finally found out this week what they meant by that. It's their jobs.
Absolutely. It always is, isn't it?
Well, it hasn't always been that way. I've been at this for what's getting to be a long time, and I have never once, and this is the fourth redistricting and reapportionment that I've gone through in a professional sense in my lifetime. So that covers a 40-year period, roughly. This is the fourth one. I have never seen anything quite this bold, quite this brazen, and I have certainly not ever seen anybody have the colossal gall, the true chutzpah, if you will, allow me to use a word from my own mother tongue, to suggest that this was an open process, much less the most open process in history, which is how it's been described by people like Representative Daryl Metcalf, who was who took the reins of this thing and drew himself a district out in western Pennsylvania that assures that he gets reelected, because that's the job program that he was really interested in.
Yeah, he certainly protected himself. And you look at this, and this is why I hope people will be paying attention and getting those folks out. Anyway, I got to take a break here. I wish you and your family nothing but the best this holiday season, and we look forward to talking to you next year.
I look forward to it as well, and most importantly, not only to you and your staff there, who does such a wonderful job and is so kind in inviting me onto the show so regularly, but also to all of our listeners, a happy, safe, peaceful, and healthy holiday season and new year. And may we stand strong together in the new year as we have this year, so that we can beat back this impressive conduct.
Outstanding. Erwin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take good care.
Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
It's at this time of year that generous, big-hearted Americans reach out to aid the less fortunate among us, like those who've recently been knocked down by the recession and seen their incomes plummet. I speak, of course, about our nation's severely squeezed millionaires. Yes, many of the infamous 1% class are no longer feeling like $1 million. According to a new federal report, the income of these high living swells averaged a robust $1.4 million in 2007. But after Wall Street crashed in a heap of greed late that year, their average income took a tumble. In 2009, it fell below the millionaire threshold, leaving these poor rich folks struggling to make it on an average income of only $957,000. Also, talk about getting a lump of coal in your Christmas stocking. The share of our nation's total income taken by the one percenters fell from a whopping 23% in 2007 to a mere 17% 2 years later. How sad for them, huh? The only balm for their little financial ouchie is that they are using it as a rebuke to the 99%ers of the Occupy Wall Street protests. See, say the rich, waving the federal report, our slice of the pie in 2009 was the smallest it's been in a decade, so your protest about inequality is out of date. Get a time machine, one front man for the Koch brothers barked at the Occupy movement. This is Jim Hightower saying, okay, but let's travel back only a few short years in time to 1980, when the top 1% was very happy to pocket a meager 10% of all of America's income. And by the way, today's 1%ers have had big income gains since 2009, while the 99% have lost income. So, the occupiers are right, the inequality is increasing.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
That's what it is, business as usual. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. So the question is, are rich people less sympathetic, less empathetic than average everyday people? Do rich people have a cold heart? Are they evil, steely? Are they the Ebenezer Scrooges of the Dickens era? Or, as Jennifer Stoller, who in her piece says, they're not cold-hearted. It's just not that they're cold-hearted. It's that they've just never experienced the things that poor people have. So they have no idea how it feels. They have no way of understanding. And, you know, as I'm reading through this study, and part of me goes, look, the reality is when you pursue a tax cut that is going to take food out of the mouths of children, when you pursue a tax cut that you know is going to be taken from a social safety net program that is going to strip health care or unemployment benefits, when you decide that, yeah, I'm going to take that money and shift it from the common good to my buddy, my campaign donor, what does that say about us? And what does that say about the person who's getting it? I mean, we've seen some of the investor class say, look, you need to tax us more. Times are great. We've never had it any better. We're paying less taxes than we have in 60 years. Our share of the income is through the roof. We're better off than the Romans were. And yet there are some. And I know it's easy to paint them as you know, as evil, cold-hearted, fat cats. And some of them are. But the reality is it's our policy. I mean, it's easy to demonize people, and I do it sometimes too. But it's our policy. It's the people in Washington. It's the people in Harrisburg. It's the people in state houses. It's even us for voting for people who tell you, I'm going to cut taxes on the very wealthy with this bizarre ideology that somehow, some way, giving everything to the top, rolling that ball up to the top and saying, here, oh great one. Do with our money what you will. That somehow it's going to rain down on us. That rivers of gold and honey will flow and everyone's pockets will be full. It's just never going to happen. You know, this idea that we give them all and that their pockets will eventually get full is never going to happen. It's never happened. But, you know, never want to lose a good friend. Got to pursue that good friend. So when I saw this story today, now remember, the people that we sent to Afghanistan, the people that we sent to Iraq, these are our heroes. These are people who put up on a pedestal. These are the people that we honor with parades and ribbons and all that stuff. They're struggling to give their children a Christmas. They've got to turn to charities to make sure that their kids get a Christmas. So I saw this story. Agency France Press reported today. Tough times. U.S. military families line up for donated Christmas gifts. And I say, you know, if these are the people that we're calling our heroes, and they have to stand in line and ask for handouts, I think I got a serious problem with our priority system. I just think we got a serious problem. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking with Pennsylvania State Representative Dante Santoni. This liquor store thing, again, I don't understand why they went after it. It was BS from the beginning, and it got crazier as we went along. Quick break, right back after this. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission. The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions. These aren't privileges to be taken away, they're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions? It's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street Movement at AFSCME13.org. And from all of us at AFSCME, happy holidays.
AFSCME13. asked me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, again, you know, you go back to this whole auctioning off of everything that is ours. Originally, they want, you know, got to get rid of the turnpike. That's an asset that the state owns, that we the people own. Let's hock that off to fill a budget gap. And then they wanted to go after the state wine and spirit shop, said $2 billion we could get would fill all of our needs. We'd be perfectly fine. But as you got into it, you realized not so much. And then you realize the job losses and all of the associated problems. And at the end, who knows what, I don't even know what they were trying to ram through at the end just to claim some kind of victory. But fortunately, hasn't happened thus far. That's why I've asked State Representative Dante Santoni, House Democratic Chairman of the Liquor Control Committee, to come talk to us a little bit about that. Representative, thanks for taking time for me.
Great to be with you, Rick.
You know, I look at this, and to me, conceptually, the sales of the wine and spirit shop, one of the few things the state actually gains revenue from, seemed to be a dumb idea from the beginning.
Well, you're right, Rick, and this all started during the last gubernatorial campaign when then-candidate Corbett came up with an idea that he could sell the state stores. And at the time, you mentioned $2 billion. He said he could generate $3 billion and never really came up with an accounting system as to how he could ever come up with that, and we were a little skeptical of all that. And then Majority Leader Terzai introduced House Bill 11, and then we started looking at the details of the bill and the money that could be generated and a whole slew of things. And it really was just a scheme to try to help some of the campaign people who gave campaign funds to Mr. Corbett and the Republican leadership. And when push came to shove, the Republican chairman, to his credit, John Taylor from Philadelphia, held public hearings, and we dissected Mr. Terzai's bill, and there were plenty of holes in it.
Yeah, and right from the beginning there were plenty of holes, and I listened to the guy, the bald guy over at the Tea Party think tank over at the Commonwealth Foundation, you know, come out with his numbers, and again, you know, reaching around back to the dark side of the moon and popping out a number, and I'm going, where'd you get that? And you look at how they came up with their numbers, I think my fourth grader could have done a better job of making something up more.
Well, they were going to double the number of licenses that were available. And in order to get to the number that they were going to get, even with the twice as many licenses that they were going to sell, they would have to sell those licenses. They would have to sell those licenses for over $1 million, which is probably about twice what the highest price. I believe it was West Virginia and one of the Pacific Northwest states privatized, and when they auctioned theirs, it wasn't even, in some cases, it was less than $200,000. So to get to that magic number that they were talking about was pure folly. And I have an accounting degree, and it was a joke as to what they were doing. And then they were coming up with all these other ideas of how, you know, first of all, we would have more selection and better prices. And then we actually looked at the facts. You know, I guess the Republicans hate when facts get in the way, but we started looking at the facts and realized that that wasn't going to be the case. Pennsylvania is the largest purchaser of wine and spirits in the United States and in the world, and the price breaks that they get because of that allow us to sell the product at a really good price and allow us, because the state oversees it, to give us terrific selection. And really, the wine and spirit shops, Rick, have come a long way from – when I was a youngster, and they're really good stores, and the employees are well trained, and they've come a long way. So we on the House Democratic side have tried to come up with some things that would make the system better, but
keep the state oversight in place, because we do have a really good system. We do have good selections. You can get any wine that you want, and if it's not in the store, we'll get it for you.
Right.
The prices are really good because of our purchasing power. So again, we blew holes in all of that Mr. Terzai and Mr. Corbett and the Republicans were talking about, and then it came down ultimately, and we also, of course, there's social implications that we can get into too. That cause problems in our society with drinking and things like that.
Yeah, which were my arguments from the beginning. Look, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Liquor was an impulse item. It was right there on the impulse aisle next to the Tic Tacs. You could get 42 proof anything sitting on at the local 7-Eleven right next to the Tic Tacs.
Yep.
And as a hypocrite, because I'm now a parent, I don't want my kids to have the access that I had.
I'm the same way. And I mean, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I can tell you that when you're a kid in Pennsylvania, and we're all young, and we all do dumb things, and we all want to get liquor more than we're not supposed to, and beer and all that, and wine, and no one ever would ever think about going into a wine and spirit shop, a state store, as they were called back then, because they just didn't serve underage youth. And when a system goes private, there's an opportunity when people are, you know, somebody's kicking my butt down the street selling more than me, I might cut a little corner and sell that to a kid that's not 21. And then, you know, we have all those issues. So, we blew holes in all their arguments, and then ultimately, Rick, it came down to, government shouldn't be in the liquor business. And that's a philosophical argument, and they can argue that all day long. But the fact of the matter is, even Terzai's own Republican Party couldn't support him. And House Bill 11 came up in committee, and it was amended, and now it's a bill that nobody even like, even the Commonwealth Foundation's against it. So we're hoping that this issue goes away. We think that the system does a good job, and then we need to talk about the jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end of this, all of this diversion, all of this nonsense, you look at what's going on this last year, a total lack of leadership anywhere in the Republican Party, and the leadership that did come to the forefront took us down the wrong path. And I go back to November of 2010, when nationally and in every state, the Republicans were saying, laser-like focus, jobs, 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 and all I've seen is stealing my right to vote, limiting the right to abortions, everything but jobs.
Well, the issue, and still it is jobs, 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 and the Republicans think the way to get the jobs and create jobs is to cut everything, and we all realize, and any economist worth their salt knows that you have to invest to create jobs, and the unfortunate thing in Harrisburg is we're in a deep minority in the House and the Senate, and of course the governor's Republican, but I think even the moderate Republicans are throwing up their hands and saying, hey, this is crazy. I mean, we can't just cut our way out of this economy. That's going to drive us deeper into the abyss that we've been in, and there's issues, of course, the liquor store jobs we're talking about cutting. We've cut, governor and the Republican majority cut over $1 billion in public education. 14,000 teachers were laid off, and we have larger class sizes and higher property taxes because of it. Of course, the transportation system, we could talk all night about the need to invest in our infrastructure and the jobs that it creates, both in the short term with, you know, the maintaining and building of roads, and in the long term with the economic development where we have good transportation infrastructure. I mean, I'm from Berks County in Pennsylvania. I'm from Berks County, PA, and we have a road project that's on hold because the governor, you know, through his no tax pledge stuff, we can't find the money to build a road, and it's really stifling our economic development. The Republican Chamber of Commerce is for doing something on transportation. So, unfortunately, Grover Norquist and the Americans for Tax Reform, or whatever they're called, have a stranglehold on a lot of state governments, including Pennsylvania, where, you know, they sign these tax pledges that they're never ever going to raise taxes for anything whatsoever, and we're crippled because it hurts us with our transportation issue. And also, I mean, another issue that's in the forefront is the Marcellus Shale and the way that those companies are making billions of dollars and not giving back to the communities and not giving back to the Commonwealth in the form of a severance tax. So there's a lot of issues that the governor has failed on, and I mean, I've been in for 20 years, Rick. I've been in the legislature, I'm entering my 20th year. I've been under Democrats and Republicans, and I've never seen a governor like this who is just as hands-off as you can be. I mean, there's been more sightings of Elvis in Pennsylvania than this governor. I mean, he is nowhere to be found, doesn't stand up for any of the issues. It's really bad, and Pennsylvania is suffering deeply because of it.
I got to be honest with you, though, Representative. I think I want him playing Punxsutawney Phil. I think I want him in his rabbit hole, in his little hovel, because if he comes out, only bad things, in my opinion, can happen, like going after the wine and spirit shops, like trying to privatize and profitize public education and destroy public education in this state. I'm perfectly happy just paying him to do out his term and do nothing else. There's part of me that says that.
That's not a bad strategy, but I just think, you know, Pennsylvania can't afford for him to sit back for 4 years. If I was the governor or king or whatever, I would look at this transportation infrastructure issue as really important because, as I said, you know, it's a safety issue. It is becoming a huge safety issue where bridges are being compromised. We have terrible road systems. I mean, we're going to have to start closing bridges, and some have already been closed. We have some in Berks County that are just in terrible shape. I mean, the infrastructure in our Commonwealth is desperate, and we don't want a tragedy to happen like that, but not in Minnesota a couple of years ago, where bridges collapsed when people are on them, and that's what we're looking at doing if we don't do something. So, I mean, at the very least, he has to come out and the Republicans and the Chamber of Commerce of the world even support this. So we need to do something about that because, as I said earlier, talking about jobs, we're going to create jobs in the short term with the road construction and the maintenance and things like that, and we're also going to have long-term job creation because a good infrastructure keeps businesses in our communities, brings business in, jobs, good-paying jobs, and we really need the governor. I agree with that. I don't want him to come out of his hole to talk about these other crazy stuff like privatization of liquor stores, vouchers.
But the stuff you can agree on.
Getting rid of the prevailing wage, all the other issues that hurt working Pennsylvanians, but on some of those things, he has to get off his duff.
Yeah, I mean, the things you can agree on, the things that make sense, like, because I've been saying that the Republicans have brought prayer back to Pennsylvania. Now, I know they claim to be the party of prayer, but not in this isn't a good way. I mean, most people that I talk to, you know, they say a little prayer before they go over a bridge. Oh, please, Lord, don't let this bridge collapse with me on it. I know that's the kind of praying that we need people doing.
I mean, it's funny, but it's not funny because we don't want those kind of issues, and that's what it's coming to. Every day that we do nothing, and we're done for the calendar year. Now we come back into session in January, and we're hearing that he's going to bring the privatization stuff up and the voucher stuff up. Fact of the matter is, he put a watered down version of school vouchers before the legislature, dealing with charter schools and other things, and it failed. I mean, his own party's not supporting it.
Now let me ask you about that for a second, because you know I look at this, and to me the voucher part is a bad idea. The charters I'm not overly thrilled with, but to me the EITC thing was, and I can't find many people against this. I think that's a bad idea. I think giving these big companies the ability to say, here's a boatload of money, and oh by the way, you know, we want something for it. The potential of a quid pro quo to me is ever more in danger, ever more dangerous than the vouchers.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we need to invest in our public schools. I mean, you know, if people want to go to private and parochial schools, that's fine. That's all well and good. They can pay that. But we need to invest in our public schools because, you know, without it, we don't have an educated electorate who can't get jobs. I mean, it's just critical. Under Ed Rendell, and people can criticize him for whatever they want, but the fact of the matter is he did a great job on education. He had smaller class sizes and had programs for preschool, full-day kindergarten. He invested, and we're starting to see the fruits of that.
Absolutely.
It takes a few years. It's not just one election where that you can see how that works, and that we're starting to see the fruits of that. Kids are becoming better equipped, and as they enter this new technological age of, you know, all these computers and everything else that I'm still trying to figure out myself as a 51-year-old man, but this guy's knocking it all back. He's taking it all back because he's got this, you know, this hell-bent idea of privatizing our schools and providing vouchers and everything else related to that because of some deep-pocketed people in Philadelphia that gave him a lot of money. And I guess I do know where he's coming from with his philosophy, but hopefully he doesn't have the votes on his side to do that. I don't think he has the votes for vouchers. He couldn't even, as I said, get a scaled-down, watered-down version of it passed. It failed miserably, so.
I'm glad to hear that, and I'm hoping that next year a little sanity returns. Maybe we get some positive things done. I appreciate the time. I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this. And again, I wish you guys the best in the new year. I wish you and your family a happy holiday and a happy new year as well.
And we're going to keep fighting, Rick, and I wish you and all the listeners a happy holiday season and a happy and prosperous and healthy new year.
And we look forward to talking to you back here next year.
Look forward to it.
State Representative Dante Santoni, House Democratic Chairman of the Liquor Control Committee. Quick break right back after this. When we come back, we're going to talk with Representative Joe Markosik, House Democratic Appropriations Chairman, back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippens.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says House Republicans need to decide whether they stand with the wealthiest 1% or they can come to their senses and stand for working people and pay attention to the jobs crisis. The Labor Federation is calling on House Speaker Boehner to lead his caucus to pass the bipartisan Senate bill that would extend jobless benefits and the payroll tax break working families need. The AFL-CIO says it's a modest compromise that would help millions of families. Senate Republicans are afraid that President Obama will use his recess appointment powers to seat nominees to the National Labor Relations Board. Republicans are blocking the nominations because they don't want a functioning labor board protecting workers' rights. All 47 GOP senators signed a letter warning Obama not to make the appointments. According to a report by Good Jobs First, states are spending billions of dollars each year on corporate tax credits, cash grants, and other taxpayer economic subsidies that require little or no job creation from those companies in return. The report, Money for Something, rates the performance standards and job quality requirements of 238 key subsidy programs from the 50 states and the District of Columbia. Together, they cost more than $11 billion a year. This corporate tax welfare spends tax dollars without gaining any good jobs for the states in return. Good Jobs First Executive Director Greg LeRoy says with joblessness still so high, taxpayers have a right to expect that economic development investments of tax dollars create significant numbers of high-quality jobs. The full report is available at goodjobsfirst.org. 200 workers have lost their jobs at a big foundry due to a sweep by the Office of Homeland Security, Jesse Russell reports.
The country's third largest foundry is letting go of 200 workers. The Office of Homeland Security did a sweep of the Pacific Steel Foundry, seeking workers who couldn't provide a valid Social Security number. One-third of the employees couldn't do so, and only a handful were able to produce new documents clarifying their legal status. The layoffs come as the company has been seeing an uptick in demand. Since the start of this year, 130 workers have been added at the plant, which pays an average of $18 per hour. Many of the laid-off workers had been employed at the factory for more than two decades.
A strike at Charles de Gaulle Airport in France is entering its sixth day this morning. The strike was launched by workers seeking an increase in pay. The Civil Aviation Authority said it plans to bring in replacement workers to help lighten the impact of the strike on holiday travelers. This newscast made possible in part by ULICO, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, and OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you've missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or you can get the Stitcher app on your smartphone and take the program on the go. So I don't know if you saw this. Budget Secretary Charles Zogby is mid-year budget briefing, projecting a $500 million revenue shortfall. Some questions. The numbers, are they accurate? This guy pulling stuff out of the dark side of the moon. The other part of this for me is I question his leadership. I question the vision, the commitment to working people that these Republicans have. You remember laser-like focus, jobs, jobs, jobs? When all we've seen is division, delay, destruction. No jobs, jobs, jobs. And even the radicals in the party, you got to wonder what they're thinking now that they've been turned back. Because, you know, they took the party down a really kind of a radical fringe path. And fortunately here in Pennsylvania, still some sanity left in the GOP. And I think that has to do an awful lot with the fact that, you know, you still have some good relationships with Republicans. The Tea Party didn't take over in whole, in mass. Yeah, I got a couple of Tea Twizzlers out there. You got a couple of people out on the radical fringe. But for the most part, these are people who, you know, they just want to, they kind of agree. We should have wages that support a family. We want an infrastructure that is not going to destroy my car every time I leave the house. So, you know, again, you got to look at what went on. Pretty happy about the results to this point. The voter thing, I'm hoping at some point, in a couple of years, we push back on that. But for the most part, pretty fortunate. We have avoided the insanity. Now, we'll see what happens next year, because, you know, there's part of me that says they're going to come back guns a-blazing. Because after all, remember, they have absolute power. It doesn't matter what the Democrats do. If they keep their numbers together, they will be able to steamroll. And I really thought that last November. I really thought that with Corbett in the governor's mansion and the Republicans with such overwhelming numbers, that it would just be Bill come up, Bill get passed, Bill get signed. And they would get every insane right-wing ALEC piece of legislation that would come down the pike. I really thought that.
You have to understand something, Rick. Some of these issues are very controversial. One of them is vouchers, and that's then you know that there were a lot of Republicans that came over to our side. There's a couple other issues. One of them is the state stores. Some of these Republicans are in districts that aren't totally safe, even though the Republicans have been in charge now the last two times, the last two reapportionment efforts. They've been in charge, plus this year is a presidential, and historically, Rick, Democrats come out, and now we have the biggest advantage in voter registration that we've ever had. And if they come out in some of these close districts, if the Republicans cast too many votes that are too far to the right, they could find themselves out of a job. So I think that's one thing that's going to really help us this next year, the political reality of some of their votes. So I think they'll be a little bit reticent to go to the more to the right than they are now.
But again, you know, you look at the stuff that they went after, all of the divisive stuff. They went after the abortion. They went after their golden tickets, their privatization. They went after all of these things that mainstream people don't want. People want jobs. People want them focusing on how do you bring more revenue so my local property taxes don't go up. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to some of the stories throughout the states, but communities are raising their taxes because they don't have a choice. The state has slashed their funding. School districts are being starved out. You're talking about almost $1 billion ripped out of public education. And then they want to throw on top of that a privatization scheme. It defies logic. But again, if you stop and you think about what it is that they're really pushing, there's no logic there anyway. And, you know, the gay marriage thing, I was waiting for that to pop up. And I don't know if you saw Pat Robertson. Again, this guy's an absolute kook. Just an absolute kook. He was talking, well, listen to this clip. I mean, I guess I just got to play it in its entirety.
Tommy says, how do you show your gay son the love of Jesus when you know his sexual preference is an abomination to God?
Well, you can love, you know what they say, you love the sinner and hate the sin, but I think what you've got to do is love him, and you're his father, and you want to say, look, I don't agree with what you're doing. You can always say that. But
yeah, you can always say that. I love you, son, and I just don't like what you're doing. And that way, if he stopped right there, I'd go, okay, yeah, that's what I hear most of the time. But no. No, the insanity, the I don't even know what the right word is.
I love you as you're my son. You know, you came from my body. You're part of me, and I'm with you. But I'd like you to get out of this.
So you came from my body. You're part of me. So I'm thinking this, and I'm going, this can only go really insane.
I know people disagree in the question of homosexuality. Is it something that they're born with? Is something that's acquired? I think a lot of it is acquired. I don't know all the genes or the genetics that's in your son as to what's causing him to do whatever he's doing, but you'll have to figure that one out. But normally speaking, a person who has acquired this can unacquire it. And they can. We've had many people who have indeed left the homosexual lifestyle and gone into a heterosexual relationship and been very, very happy. So, but all I can say is love the son. Love the son and show him what you consider a better way.
There you go. The insanity. You can unacquire it, evidently. I didn't know you could unacquire it. And when I listened to him speak, I thought of the Billy Madison.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
May God have mercy on his soul. And you know, that's the only, whenever I hear him speak, that's the only thing I can come up with.
Well, you know, I mean, we all have opinions on this issue. And I think I'm basically like you. Do I really care if someone's gay? No, I don't care. It doesn't bother me. Live and let live. However, for those who, and I've heard this from some of my friends and I get so frustrated. Well, it's learned. That conduct is learned. If you talk to gay people, a lot of them will tell you, hey, I knew at an early age. You're talking 3 or 4 years old, or that they knew that they were different and they were attracted to members of the same sex. Now, how could you at that age, when you're pretty much considered innocent, how could you at that point be considered someone who has a learned conduct? It just, these people, you know, you can't, doesn't matter what evidence you present to those people, their political philosophy says that, well, homosexuality is a sin before God, therefore it must be a learned behavior. God couldn't and wouldn't create you gay. He just wouldn't, according to them.
It's just nuts. But I guess you can unacquire it. So good for him. You know, it's one of those things we now can unacquire. Wow. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
It's at this time of year that generous, big-hearted Americans reach out to aid the less fortunate among us, like those who've recently been knocked down by the recession and seen their incomes plummet. I speak, of course, about our nation's severely squeezed millionaires. Yes, many of the infamous 1% class are no longer feeling like $1 million. According to a new federal report, the income of these high living swells averaged a robust $1.4 million in 2007. But after Wall Street crashed in a heap of greed late that year, their average income took a tumble. In 2009, it fell below the millionaire threshold, leaving these poor rich folks struggling to make it on an average income of only $957,000. Also, talk about getting a lump of coal in your Christmas stocking. The share of our nation's total income taken by the one percenters fell from a whopping 23% in 2007 to a mere 17% 2 years later. How sad for them, huh? The only balm for their little financial ouchie is that they are using it as a rebuke to the 99%ers of the Occupy Wall Street protests. See, say the rich, waving the federal report, our slice of the pie in 2009 was the smallest it's been in a decade, so your protest about inequality is out of date. Get a time machine, one front man for the Koch brothers barked at the Occupy movement. This is Jim Hightower saying, okay, but let's travel back only a few short years in time to 1980, when the top 1% was very happy to pocket a meager 10% of all of America's income. And by the way, today's 1%ers have had big income gains since 2009, while the 99% have lost income. So, the occupiers are right. The inequality is increasing.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside there's feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard of Republicans?
Yeah, it's okay. You can do it. You can give them a hug. Even if Pat Robertson says no, you can do it. It's all right, I guess. I'm not a big hugger, but some I know our producer Brett is, so there you go. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. You know, I talk to people from, you know, from Wisconsin. We talk to people from Ohio. We were in both of those places during the big battles this year, and they asked the same question. How did you avoid it? How did you, in Pennsylvania, get away from the insanity that started in Wisconsin and swept across Ohio and Indiana and Florida and Michigan and Maine and Tennessee and all of these states? How'd you miss it? I think rational thought kind of had something to do with it. And the fact that the radicals were few. That's why I've asked Representative Joe Markosik, House Democratic Appropriations Chairman, to come talk to us a bit about this past year and what to look for in the coming year. Representative, thanks for taking time for me.
It's going good. Glad to be here.
You know, I look at what's going on, and all the attacks were there. All of the insane policy was there. It just somehow got fought back here.
Well, I think a lot has to do with our history here and the strength of our working people in Pennsylvania and the attitudes that we have. I think that had a lot to do with it. I think the folks who took over state government last year, the governor and the Republican majorities in both houses, had their hands full with their own agenda, and I think this wasn't part of it for whatever reason, at least not this year. I would certainly warn everybody to be vigilant. We're embarking on another year now. I think we saw them fail in a number of their priorities last year. They didn't get Marcellus Shale vouchers, some other issues passed that state store, their so-called state store reform, all that stuff is still on the table. They said they'd have it done early. The only thing they've really accomplished is getting the budget done on time, but keep in mind they had both houses and the governor's office all on the same team, and they got it passed with 15 minutes to spare. So, you know, you might want to call that a slight victory, or they might want to call that a victory, but, boy, I think overall they've not had their feet on the ground, and they really haven't been together on a lot of these issues. And I think we, the Democrats in the House and Senate, as well as, you know, our alliances with working people and working families have remained strong and together, and we've continued to be strong with what we believe.
Yeah, every night we've been talking about all the issues on this program, and our listeners have participated and contacted their representatives. And as a representative, when people call you and say, hey, I heard this, or hey, I read this, how important is it when you get a phone call for someone, or heaven forbid we go back and sit down and put pen to paper and send it through the postal service? How important is that?
Well, I've always said the more effort people put into contacting a legislator, the more valuable it is. If you put little effort in, you know, signing a petition is really a pretty easy thing to do, or sending out a form letter that, you know, you get, say, here, push this button and click on this, and this will automatically get mailed to your legislator. That's easy, and quite frankly, we get a million of those. But when I see a letter that comes in that somebody hand-wrote, or when somebody personally calls me and wants to talk to me, I make it my point to talk to them or to personally, you know, respond to that. So I think it's a stronger, the more effort that folks put into contacting a legislator, the more I think the better it is, and the more effective it is, you know, for gaining the interest of that legislator.
Yeah, because for every piece of legislation that comes up, you know, one way or the other, we say, hey, you should be calling your representative and tell them what you think. And a lot of times I think people go, well, you know, I called and they took my name and information and that's the end of it. But there's actually something behind that.
Well, right. If you know, my philosophy in my office, and I tell my staff this, if we get a form letter, then it's perfectly fine for us to send a form letter back. If somebody sends us something a little more creative or, you know, puts a little more work into it, then we do the same. We respond in kind. So I think that's just kind of, government 101 or democracy 101, if you will. Right. It makes sense. The more effort and time, work you put into something, the better the result's going to be.
Let me ask you this. You know, I'm happy to see all of the insanity kind of getting pushed back. The voucher scheme, the EITC thing, you know, the privatization of the wine and spirits shops. A lot of the insanity got pushed aside, but the problem is we've now wasted an entire year. There are so many lost opportunities, and we still have people in our community who are struggling, people who still don't have jobs, and this gridlock, this delay, this diversion hasn't done much to help them.
But you've hit the nail right on the head. We spent a lot of time with these issues that really, in my opinion, at the beginning of the year, I thought were long shots to begin with. But nevertheless, we passed up what I think is probably the biggest issue, and the governor and the Republican leadership in the legislature has pretty much ignored, and that's transportation. And there's no greater job creator than rebuilding our infrastructure. And you know, I think even the general public out there, of both parties, of all through the state, the urban, suburban, rural, understands that transportation is important, and they understand that our current infrastructure is geriatric and it's crumbling, and it's going to be a tragic situation. It's going to be a economic development killer, and we could just have a lot of good paying family-supporting jobs if we would just get busy, bite the bullet, and rebuild our transportation infrastructure. And I think there'd actually be a lot of bipartisan support for that.
I would hope so, because it makes sense, especially now when rates are so low and you could borrow money so low. My problem with some of the legislation that's going around is this idea of these P3s, this public-private partnership stuff. And I'm not sure where you're at on it, but I say if we need to bring in profiteers and privatizers, why shouldn't we just do it for ourselves?
Well, I fought, respectably, our last governor, Governor Rendell, over his idea to lease the turnpike for 99 years, for 75 years, which I thought would have been really a bad idea. I'm glad we were able to defeat that.
Me too.
And as many things as I might have agreed with them on, that was one that I did not. So I'm not a big, I'm not one of these people that's, back selling our valuable infrastructure or our valuable assets. Well, one, you know, if somebody else could make money on them, then why aren't we? And I would also just say, as far as P3s are concerned, I don't oppose them diametrically. I think that'd be only a really small part of our transportation program, even if we did pass them. But let's face it, the public-private partnership program is just another way to borrow money. And it's perhaps not even the most efficient way to borrow money. We could be better off just floating bonds rather than going to a private company, having them put up the money, and then they take ownership of the asset for many years and get the profits from it.
See, there you go. You know, we had talked with Donna Cooper, who was in the Rendell administration, and she was talking about the privatization of the turnpike where they wanted to lease it off. And she said something that really caught my attention. She said that the people who are going to put the money up, they actually wanted a guarantee of the profits that they would have made had they used the money somewhere else. So the state was going to have to guarantee them the profits, which is why I guess the whole thing fell apart.
It was a bad financial deal. I think it would have been perhaps some short-term gain there, but over the long term, especially for 75 years, you might as well say that you've given it away for about three generations.
And what would you get?
To me,
that
was just a bad idea.
Yeah, and what would we have gotten back? So, you know, let me bring this back, because I think what has to happen in this new year, and I'm afraid that we're going to refight the same battles over again, that they're going to come back, lick their wounds, and start over. How do we make sure that the focus is, as they said in November of 2010, a laser-like focus on jobs, jobs, jobs?
Well, folks can listen to us, because that's what we've been saying in the Democratic caucus in the House and Senate. I think all legislators of both parties are going to start feeling it. It is an election year coming up. The entire state house, federal house, and of course, half the state senate are up for reelection this year. And I think, look around. I mean, we have about a 8.5% unemployment in Pennsylvania. We're a little bit better than national, but it's certainly not great. I think anybody that doesn't think that jobs is the number one issue, I mean, it just boggles my mind how there can't be any other issue. And again, I have a pet project. One of my favorites for job creation is transportation and rebuilding infrastructure. I was the former chairman of the Transportation Committee and really have a passion for that. And I do think it's such a huge, huge need. We have to do it. There's a lot of jobs, and it's a safety issue, too. I mean, we have bridges where school buses drop the kids off, drive across, and then pick them up on the other side after they walk across, because they don't want to go across the bridge with full kids because it's deficient.
Wow.
We have 6,000 deficient bridges that are state-owned. That doesn't include the ones owned by counties and local governments that are deficient as well. So it's a huge, massive undertaking, and we're not even starting. We're not even thinking about it. It's just a shame, and I just think we're all going to pay the price. It's not cheaper to fix the bridge next year or the road next year. It just gets more and more expensive, and the older all this infrastructure gets, the more and more of these projects get put on the deficient list. And it's a growing problem, and we have to deal with it.
Yeah, and here's the thing. What gets me is this is 30 years of anti-tax. This is 30 years of Grover Norquist. This is 30 years of, hey, vote for me. I'm not going to raise your taxes.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's we're going to have to bite the bullet. We have no choice. This isn't something, that any politician necessarily wants to do, is, anything that's politically unpopular. But I'll tell you, in my career, I've done it. I've put those votes up three times in my career, as a matter of fact. And, every time I did it, sure, there was an outcry from some people. But I think now, more than any other time since I've been a legislator, and I'm in my 30th year, more than any other time, I see the public as well as the legislature, many people in the legislature, understanding that we have to have some sort of transportation infrastructure program. Think about it this way. You can spend maybe, people don't want to spend 5 cents more on a gallon of gas, for a tax, but what happens when they shut the bridge down in your neighborhood and you have to buy 5 extra gallons of gas every week because you've got a long way around or you've got to sit in traffic?
Yeah, or I got to get my shocks replaced every year because the potholes are so deep.
You got it.
Well, last question I've got for you, and I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. You look at this gerrymandering that's gone on. I shouldn't say it that way. You look at the reapportionment and the redistricting. I wanted to get your thoughts.
Well, certainly the federal redistricting we just did is a real disaster. I mean, there's some districts there that are just really bad, and that was just drawn up by the Republicans. The state house and senate's a little bit better. Because it is a five-person commission, at the end of the day, the two sides had to agree or else they wouldn't have had anything passed. But, the Republicans, where they could use their power and their strength, they did. And it's not pretty. It could hurt the Democrats for a long time unless the public gets wise to it and understands what the current leadership is trying to do. And I just think I think we're going to see an uprising here in the next year or so. I think the tables will turn, as they always do, and I think we're going to be emerging here, and things are going to change.
I sure hope so, because at the end of this, it's my hope that we end up doing something like the people in Iowa did. Take it out of the political realm, make it an independent commission or whatever, but get it out of the hands of politicians.
That's a possibility. There's some talk about that right now.
Nothing against you, but, you know, look, when anybody's got their own self-interest in what's going on, they're naturally going to help themselves.
Sure.
Representative Joe Markosik, I appreciate your time. I hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday, and we look forward to talking to you again in the new year.
Yes, sir, Rick. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate your time. State Representative Joe Markosik, House Democratic Appropriations Chairman. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. A living wage, health benefits, safe working conditions. These aren't privileges to be taken away. They're rights to be protected. This is Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Public services and workers' rights are under attack like never before. But the Main Street movement is pulling together. Nurses, firefighters, cops, teachers, students, and neighbors. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Coming after workers and their unions? It's a shameful agenda for Wall Street politicians, but AFSCME's been in this fight for 75 years. We're not about to stop now. Join the Main Street Movement at AFSCME13.org.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so. But now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/befree and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So on this day, back in 1790, Samuel Slater opened up his thread spinning factory in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, which they claim launched the Industrial Revolution here in the U.S. And guess who he had doing the work? That's right, children. 7 to 12-year-olds worked dawn to dusk in this production facility built by Samuel Slater. He paid them about 55 cents a week. Good wages back then. Not really. And you know, I go back and I think about how the whole progression of child labor. And you got Newt Gingrich saying, "Oh well, shameful, truly stupid," was his words. And I thought back immediately to the two girls over the summer in Illinois who were working for Monsanto, two 14-year-old girls who were electrocuted doing something called detasseling or tasseling or whatever it was. And I thought, you know, should they really be doing that working for Monsanto, a multinational corporation? And the answer is no. Anyway, here to talk to us about child labor and what's going on. I guess something's going on in Congress. Justin Feldman, worker health and safety advocate over at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. Justin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to speak to you. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I go back to these two girls back, I think it was somewhere in Illinois, Tampico, Illinois, working for Monsanto, electrocuted, doing some task. I'm not even sure what it is. But my question is, why are they working for Monsanto, 14 years old, a multinational corporation? I thought the exemption was for family farmers.
Well, shockingly, you can be as young as 12 years old in this country and work on a farm, and depending on what state, work unrestricted hours. And this doesn't align with other industries where there's lots of restrictions. You have to have a work permit if you're 14, there's restricted hours, et cetera. And there is supposed to be regulations that restrict the only protection that there is. Regulations restricting what tasks you can and cannot do. And the Department of Labor defines what those tasks are, but that the regulations have not been updated in 40 years.
Right.
So the Department of Labor is trying to put out new rules, but they're getting some pushback from, they just received a letter from 30 senators opposing the rule all out. And we have 4 Democrats and 26 Republicans signing on to that letter.
And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, I understand leaving an exemption for kids whose parents own the farm. Because the idea being, you're not going to put your own child in harm's way, and you're going to treat them right. Or at least you hope. But working for somebody like Monsanto, I'm sorry, I'm missing the point there, and I think it should be regulated. I think we should be redefining these roles. But as you've pointed out, 30 senators, it kind of shows you the power of big agribusiness in this country.
Absolutely. And we've just been hearing a lot of misinformation being spread about what these regulations mean. We've been hearing that they will all out prevent children from working on their parents' farms, or your grandma will get arrested if you harvest their corn or something like that. But this is just lies that are being spread by agribusiness who want to continue to exploit children, often migrant workers. And they are trying to put out these spurious arguments and confuse people and make them worry that their rural way of life is under threat, when in fact these are very modest rules, and we should be going a lot further. And Congress has failed time and time again to fix the loopholes in child labor law that let children work on farms.
And again, you look at this and you go, you know, you judge a society how they treat their elderly and their children and their poor. And I look at this, another example of I don't think we're doing really well.
No, not at all.
So what should we be looking at? I mean, what's the answer here? I mean, we want children to be able to work there, because I do believe there are some therapeutic qualities in work. There are lessons to be learned. But I also don't want them demolishing barns. I don't want them dealing with pesticides. I don't want them, you know, driving heavy machinery. Where should we be going?
Yeah, well, the first step would be to, hopefully the Obama administration will allow these regulations to get issued in their final form. They've let it go to this at this point, and these regulations are just restrictions on particularly hazardous jobs that the federal government has already done research on and determined were hazardous, like, as you said, handling pesticides, working in demolition, working with large non-castrated animals and things like that. So that'd be one step. But then the other step is having Congress pass what's been introduced a few times called the CARE Act, which would, first of all, restrict very young children from working on farms at all, and also limit hours.
Now, does this have anything to do with, would it in any way protect those illegals that we keep hearing about? I mean, because there was a story over the summer, right about the same time that these two girls were electrocuted, there was a 16-year-old boy, I think, died in a field from heat exhaustion, and nobody was really paying attention to that.
Yeah. Well, worker safety laws tend to protect everyone, regardless of your immigration status. or that they're supposed to. We see that people are put in a very vulnerable situation. They're worried about being deported or not finding jobs elsewhere. And there's also these agencies like Department of Labor and OSHA do not have enough funding to enforce the laws that they're supposed to be enforcing. So there's not a lot of inspections going on farms, and usually when they're responding to something, it's because some tragedy has already occurred.
Yeah. And what's amazing to me is you keep hearing the, people like Michelle Bachmann and the rest of Snow White's Seven Dwarfs, talking about job killing regulations. And I often wonder, especially in the case of those two girls, how many lives are lost because there are no regulations? Or that they're weak?
At least in the working world, they directly from injuries, we see 4,500 in the last year, people dying on the job, and then another perhaps 45 or 50,000 dying from occupational illnesses like mesothelioma from asbestos exposure, other diseases like that.
So let me ask you, Jeffrey Feldman, what do we do? How do we help push this through? How do we make sure that that this becomes the law of the land?
Well, the comment period is actually over for this, so it's kind of curious that the Senate is, certain senators are trying to take action after the time period. We collected a petition, we had petitions for this particular rule, but I guess it's just to put pressure on the Obama administration, to let them know that we care, we're going to hold them accountable, make sure they don't back off of this rule despite the opposition to it.
Yeah, that's the hope anyway. Ben Nelson, another good Democrat out spearheading this, as I understand.
That's right.
And you know, you go, where did these Democrats come from? It's the same handful, in my opinion. It's always the same ones.
Yeah, this is the blue dogs, some rural states who are, they pretty sure all receive large contributions from agribusiness, the Farm Bureau.
Yeah, their pockets are well filled. Justin Feldman, I appreciate the time. Worker health and safety advocate over at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. We've got a link to his piece over at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Justin Feldman's name. Justin, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, I look at this, and you look at Gingrich coming out saying, "Well, if it's truly stupid, we should put those kids to work cleaning toilets and get rid of those union janitors because they make too much money." And that's the ideology, though. If we can use those exploitable children, get them out there because they don't know any better, and get rid of that guy who's feeding his family with that job, life would be so much better. At least that's what they tell us, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's absolutely insane the length to which some of these Republican candidates. How many people?
And Democrats are four Democrats of the 30.
Well, those are lost causes. What can I say? They're kind of like rhinos.
It's easy to go after the Republicans.
We ought to form a new word: dimos. Democrats in name.
They're dinos.
Dinos. Okay. You don't hear of them anyway. My point is this: how many voters are going to be attracted to the position that he took? I mean, really. Only the extreme right would say, that a boy, Newt. How many people, even from just a common sense compassion stance would say, Newt, you're right. Very, very few. I mean, Newt must be desperate. That's all I can say.
Well, Newt was going up, now Newt is going down. But, again, I go back and I think, look, and this is one of those situations where you can easily be painted as someone who, you're against children, or you're against, children being able to work. No. When I was 8 years old, I took out my first paper route. I delivered the Cleveland Press for several years. And when I was 9, I took out a plain dealer route. Was I working too much at the time? Probably. In the morning, I'd deliver the paper, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. In the afternoon, I'd deliver the press until I got fired from that job with the Cleveland Press because, they went out of business. My first job loss. I was about, I think it was 9 or, I think it was 10 or 11 years old. My first job loss. Thanks to, them going broke. But I cut grass in the summer and I shoveled snow and, did all of those things that I think most kids do to make a couple extra bucks. And there truly is some lessons in that. There truly is the work ethic, the lessons that you learn from accomplishment and being paid and putting money in your pocket. And you know, look, when I was a kid, money was tight in our house. You know, so if I wanted, for instance, the non-store brand macaroni and cheese, I wanted the brand name, I was going to have to buy that myself. Mm-hmm. And that meant going and shoveling sidewalks and driveways and cutting grass and doing whatever I could do to earn a couple of bucks. And a lot of times, you know, closer to the end of the month, you know, that money came in handy. And I'm all in favor of children learning that, which is why I think it's a damn shame that every paper route is now taken by adults. The economy has gotten so bad that you've got adults delivering newspapers. Kids should be doing that. And what they did with that, and it's you know, it's masterful. A couple of kids got snatched up and killed and been happening for generations. That's how one of the ways they got rid of that. They scared the hell out of people. And they do that masterfully. And they took that away. And now we've got adults. It's now an adult business. Same thing with cutting grass. Cutting grass used to be kids. Good neighborhood kids come here and cut the grass. I can't find a neighborhood kid to cut my grass.
You'd be surprised how many people I know are in that business now.
No, because there's nothing else. You know,
that's
right. There's no manufacturing.
Right.
We've given away our entire industry. We've said, go ahead, yeah, deindustrialize. Tear it all down. Let our factories crumble because we're going to have a service-based economy. I'll deliver you your newspaper and you come and cut my grass. That's what our economy is, the jobs our kids used to do, the things I used to do when I was a kid to put a couple of extra bucks in my pocket. And to be honest, the work ethic I learned from it has served me well. So do I want kids working? Yeah, but within rational reason and in jobs that are not going to get them killed on the job.
Well, I can relate to, I used to have a friend, when he'd go on vacation, he had a paper route, and I would take it, and I concur. It's pretty hard work, actually.
I had 300 Sundays. That's how much I had built that route up. During the week.
Yeah.
But on Sunday, you have more.
Wow.
Because more people just want the Sunday paper. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It's all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
Hello, I'm Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13. For 75 years, AFSCME has protected basic workers' rights. But Wall Street politicians are coming after workers and their unions like never before. AFSCME's Main Street movement is pulling together. Ordinary Americans are fighting back and making history. From victories in Wisconsin, Ohio, and right here in Pennsylvania, AFSCME was there. AFSCME will always be there. Join the Main Street movement at AFSCME13.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Since the investor class, diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference. The avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Got an email during the break, and of course you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Thomas writes, shoveled walks, mowed and raked grass. People had money. Hot now? Not so much. And maybe he's right. I mean, maybe... Maybe people did have more disposable income back then. Maybe the wages were a little bit better back then. Maybe that's just how it was. But here's the thing. I grew up in a housing project. To shovel a driveway in my neighborhood, and I still remember it, I got a quarter for shoveling a driveway. Which, you know, back in the middle 70s, I don't care. A quarter wasn't very much money to shovel an entire driveway. But to me, you know, it meant... You know, I had an opportunity to, you know, to buy something that I wanted. I think a box of macaroni and cheese at the time was like 15 cents.
Did you use that money to sneak in to see those terrible Cleveland Indians play? Or did you sneak in?
Not at that point, no. We weren't on the bus line at that point. So in order to go down to the Indians games, you had to be on the bus line. Now, when we moved, you know, into Lakewood and we moved, and when I moved in with my grandparents in Brooklyn, Ohio, you know, they were on the bus line. Those were better neighborhoods. The bus line ran right through. You could jump on the bus, take you right to the train station, train right downtown to the stadium. Pretty simple. But where I live, no bus line. And again, that's by design. The idea of that, again, is to make sure that the poverty areas you can't get out of. And you can say whatever you want, however it ended up. That's just the reality of it. Now, if you wanted to catch public transportation back then, in our neighborhood, you had to walk 2 or 3 miles up to near the airport to get near the bus lines. And of course, you're talking about heavily traveled roads, so it wasn't overly safe either. So even in, you know, I guess I didn't really want to get into this, but the reality is when you hear right wingers talking about poverty. When you hear right-wingers saying, I would just pull myself up by the bootstraps, I would just work harder, I'd work 2 jobs, I'd work 3 jobs, the reality is good luck on that, because you're not getting to where you need to go. There's a time frame, there's transportation, there's child care, there's a whole bunch of things that, you know, as much as my mother wanted to work, and she did, there was always the fact that in the 70s, you know, it was tough on a single woman. 70s, no friend. But having a child where you have to make sure that there's somebody home, at least part of the day. And then getting the transportation to get to and from there. She lost a couple of jobs because the car broke down. And you couldn't get there. You say, well, you know, then they should have had a backup because, you know, I would have a backup because I'm of such steely spine and intestinal fortitude. No, you wouldn't. Because nobody else in the neighborhood really had reliable transportation either. So there are a lot of obstacles. And there was a guy who penned it the best. He said it's really expensive to be poor in this country. And, you know, it is. Because you're always, you want to go take out a loan to get a car? Well, you pay the highest loan rate. And the car you get's probably not going to be a new one. It's going to be a piece of junk. And then you're going to have all the expenses that go along with repairing that hunk of junk. You know why I'm such a huge proponent of public transportation? I want everybody to have an opportunity to get from where they live to a place where they can have a decent job. Now, I know the civil engineers and the masters of our transit systems don't always think that way. But you look at some of these industrial parks, and especially when I lived in Cleveland, that started growing. We started seeing these industrial parks growing up. You couldn't get into those places without a car. If you didn't have an automobile, you didn't work at that job because public transportation didn't go in. Now it's gotten maybe a little bit better, but if you look at that article on Sunday that the kid wrote in the Patriot about the Harrisburg's transportation, which is horrible, you kind of go, try being poor and not having a car and trying to get to work. And a lot of us seem to forget that someone helped us get our first car. Someone helped us get on our feet. Someone pointed us in the right direction. Maybe someone took us to our first couple of jobs. You know, it's really easy to forget that stuff. Also got another email during the break. Disposable income, if you read Elizabeth Warren's book, The Two Income Trap, in it she talks about our disposable income having been significantly reduced in the last 30 to 50 years. Not only has, and I appreciate the email, and I look at this and I go, not only has our disposable income been taken away, we've had to have mom go into the workforce just to keep up with the bills. It used to be back when you were a kid, one parent could work, had a good paying union job, you lived a middle class existence, everybody had about the same stuff, we all grew together. And then, you know, the 70s came around, we started shipping jobs overseas, started more global trade, started doing more of the things that have taken us down the wrong path, technology, big part of it. And then the wealth gap started. The wealth class said, I want more. And they began taking back those wages. So mom has to go into the workforce, has to try and figure out how to make ends meet. And first, just start off, a little pin money. You know, I'm going to work a couple hours while the kids are in school just so we can make it to, you know, next payday. And then it became mandated. And then it became an absolute. Had to do it. Mom had to go to work. Mom had to put in 40 hours a week just like dad. And then who's raising the kids? Oh, yeah, we put them in the daycare. And then we end up getting all the problems that come along with this. And I saw a graph that just grabbed me. I think it was the Washington Post who did this. They asked who favored graphs. And it goes into how many hours per month someone would have to work in order to pay their median rent. They call it the toil index. And back in 1950, and I think this illustrates the point that I'm making pretty well. Back when you were a kid in the 50s, 40 hours a month. So you figure 10 hours a week to pay for your rent. 10 hours a week. 60s, about 45, went up just a little bit. 70s, about 42. Then you start seeing it going up. 1980, it's about 56 hours a week. 1990, it's about 60 hours a week. 2000, we're up to 72. By 2005, we're up to over 100 hours a month to pay just for our rent. And why is that? That's because our hourly wages have shrunk. Now you go back and you look at this graph. 50s, 60s, 70s, stays flat. You're about 40, 45, 40, in that area. Stays flat. Because even if the price of rent goes up, your wages are going up. You're paying it. You're working the same amount of hours. You're okay. Then you start seeing the attack on workers happening in the 70s. And then the 80s, boy, it just takes off. And now since the Great Recession, now since the Bush administration, and a massive gap between those who have and those who don't, now we're seeing those up over 100 hours a month. Just to pay your rent. I mean, in a 40-hour week, you're talking about 25 hours every week to pay your rent. That's not anything else. That's not gasoline. That's not food. That's not insurance. That's not the light bill. That's not cable. That's not electric. None of that stuff. Just your rent. And again, to me, it comes back to the fact that we have allowed the wealth class in this country to fight back against people organizing. Because back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you had a higher density of unionized workers. And you had a workforce who demanded better wages, better conditions. And then they started saying, well, gee, you know, we need to start taking those back. And my grandfather was spot on. He said, I knew it was going to have to come to an end when I took your grandmother to a meal, and my boss was sitting in the same restaurant I took your grandmother to. Knew it was the end then. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and you knew at that moment there was going to be conflict. Now, of course, they were cordial to each other at the moment, but that happened on a national scale. Look, the investor class doesn't want to rub elbows with the working class. They want no part of that. They don't care about you. You're a means of production. It's that simple. And I really didn't want to get into this, but you brought it up, and it just popped into my head. It's one of those things that at some point we've got to go back to. say, we want a better share.
Our society has devolved the wrong way. Or evolved, you can call it what you want. It's gone the wrong way. You're right, when I was growing up, I didn't realize it. When you're young, you don't realize these things. You know, mother stays home. All my neighbors knew all the kids, and it truly was a neighborhood. All the mothers looked out for everybody's kid. That's the way it was. The fathers went to work, and now when I think back, most of them did have union jobs. And, you know, on so many levels, what the conservatives have pushed for, even though they tout family values, the evolution of a world which they favor more over the last 30, 40 years has really hurt the family in so many ways. It was the Ozzie and Harriet syndrome. I mean, the mothers were there to be proper parents. There was someone home all the time. They made the food for you. And it was a good life. You didn't realize how fortunate you were at the time.
Now you're on your own. It's the ownership society. It's all for yourself, all for one, and none for the rest of you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with David Levine. He is an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law. He's co-authored a piece called Don't Break the Internet. We're going to find out about this Stop Online Privacy Act, the SOPA bill, and also the Protect ID bill out there. Right back after this.
To America. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says House Republicans need to decide whether they stand with the wealthiest 1% or they can come to their senses and stand for working people and pay attention to the jobs crisis. The Labor Federation is calling on House Speaker Boehner to lead his caucus to pass the bipartisan Senate bill that would extend jobless benefits and the payroll tax break working families need. The AFL-CIO says it's a modest compromise that would help millions of families. Senate Republicans are afraid that President Obama will use his recess appointment powers to seat nominees to the National Labor Relations Board. Republicans are blocking the nominations because they don't want a functioning labor board protecting workers' rights. All 47 GOP senators signed a letter warning Obama not to make the appointments. According to a report by Good Jobs First, states are spending billions of dollars each year on corporate tax credits, cash grants, and other taxpayer economic subsidies that require little or no job creation from those companies in return. The report, Money for Something, rates the performance standards and job quality requirements of 238 key subsidy programs from the 50 states and the District of Columbia. Together, they cost more than $11 billion a year. This corporate tax welfare spends tax dollars without gaining any good jobs for the states in return. Good Jobs First Executive Director Greg LeRoy says with joblessness still so high, taxpayers have a right to expect that economic development investments of tax dollars create significant numbers of high-quality jobs. The full report is available at goodjobsfirst.org. 200 workers have lost their jobs at a big foundry due to a sweep by the Office of Homeland Security, Jesse Russell reports.
The country's third largest foundry is letting go of 200 workers. The Office of Homeland Security did a sweep of the Pacific Steel Foundry, seeking workers who couldn't provide a valid Social Security number. One-third of the employees couldn't do so, and only a handful were able to produce new documents clarifying their legal status. The layoffs come as the company has been seeing an uptick in demand. Since the start of this year, 130 workers have been added at the plant, which pays an average of $18 per hour. Many of the laid-off workers had been employed at the factory for more than two decades.
A strike at Charles de Gaulle Airport in France is entering its sixth day this morning. The strike was launched by workers seeking an increase in pay. The Civil Aviation Authority said it plans to bring in replacement workers to help lighten the impact of the strike on holiday travelers. This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company,
and OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark ages.
If they have their choice, maybe they will take us back to the Dark Ages. And I look at this, again, you got to love the name, the Protect IP Act of 2011 and the Stop Online Piracy Act. And you go, you know, they sound reasonable. We want to protect the Internet providers, I guess. Sounds all right. We want to stop online piracy because we don't want cheaters. But what does that really mean? And I look at what this guy, Adam Savage, he's the co-host of Mythbusters, what he had to say. He said, you know what? It's going to destroy the Internet as we know it. And he says, look, make no mistake about it. These bills aren't simply unconstitutional. They're anti-constitutional. And you got to look at these things a little bit. Are we creating a situation where, well, where we're destroying something just to protect a little bit of something? That's why I've asked David Levin, assistant professor over at Elon University School of Law. He's co-written a piece called Don't Break the Internet on this very topic. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on David's name. It'll take you there. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
I look at these two pieces of legislation, and, you know, on the face, you know, well, who doesn't want to protect the Internet, and who doesn't want to stop online piracy? But the question is how will we go about it?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, look, I mean, up front, piracy is a problem in the IP world. And certainly my co-authors and I do not challenge the fact that piracy is an issue. The question is whether current law is adequate to handle it, and more specifically, whether SOPA and its Senate counterpart, the Protect IP Act, are the right way to approach it. And the fact of the matter is the bills, as written, go far beyond what is necessary into behavior that can be taken either by IP rights holders directly or by the courts that would not only be unconstitutional based on free speech grounds, not only would violate due process because the individual websites may not know that an action has been taken against them, but it also can create a serious question of filtering speech on the Internet, which goes beyond IP issues to the question of how we've built the Internet and how it's become the global medium for information sharing that it is today.
Yeah, from my perspective, and, you know, a lot of this stuff you internalize and say, how's it going to affect me? We're a small program. I don't know that I can afford a legal battle if they decide to shut my website down. Even for one reason or another, let's say I did or I didn't, that's not even the case, I guess, under this law. They can just shut you down, and you got to go battle and get it put back on, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the way that the bills are written, you know, and they're still in the markup phase. There was a markup hearing last week. And literally, this has been a moving target over the last few days. As early as a few days ago, it was thought that there would be a follow-up session this week. It appears now, as I'm chatting with you, that the bill won't be revisited until sometime in January. But literally, so long as there's an application by, let's say, a federal prosecutor alleging that a foreign website is dedicated to infringing activities, and whatever that means, the remedial power of the court to remove, if for all intents and purposes, a website from the Internet kicks in. And this can happen on the allegation of an IP rights holder without the website being present to defend itself. And that is a basic due process question and is at the core of my concern about these bills.
So in looking at this, because certainly anything like this, once it goes into effect, somebody's going to be harmed by it. We could end up in front of the Supreme Court. What are the chances of this court ruling against corporate special interest?
Well, you know, look, it's always tricky to predict how courts would handle these things. In our article, we make the case for how this violates the basic speech rights that we have with regard to prior restraints. The basic idea being that before speech is to be quashed, there needs to be a hearing, and there needs to be a final judicial decision, which does not occur under this bill. I'd be hard-pressed to predict how a court might handle this, given, again, that this is a direct constitutional issue aside from a policy.
Right. Let me ask you this. I mean, I was reading an article earlier today that they were saying they've already figured out how to get around anything that these two pieces of legislation would do, going maybe overseas, running things through foreign servers. Is this even possible? Is it even possible to do what they want to do?
Well, that's the interesting issue. You know, whenever you see legislation or even attempts being made to curb the movement of information on the Internet, there are always entities out there who try to circumvent it. And we have law that deals with those kinds of issues, like the Digital Levy and Copyright Act, the DMCA, which has anti-circumvention provisions in it designed to deal precisely with the kind of situation that might arise here. Under the DMCA, which has been law for over 10 years, if an entity makes an effort to create either software or some kind of effort to circumvent a legitimate means to prevent IP rights violations, that in and of itself is a violation of the statute. But in anticipation, fast forwarding, which is, by the way, part of the reason why, again, I think that this bill ultimately is unnecessary, because the DMCA does a very good job, and depending on your perspective, too good a job dealing with those issues. But with regard to SOPA, yes, in fact, and I was reading the same article today, you already have a DSOPA, D-E-S-O-P application, which would deal with this, but of course, based upon SOPA itself, my colleague David Post at Temple has written that in fact, the statute that is SOPA may also find that to be violative. But again, the language itself is so vague that again, the core concern would be any allegation of a potential IP rights violation could, based on the allegation, remove a website from the net.
And again, I look at someone like myself, and you know, like I said, we could never fight that kind of a challenge. And then what happens? What do you have? You know, what happens if you get someone politically into power who says, you know, we're going to go after one side or the other? Can this become a political tool?
Well, look, I mean, you know, you're getting back to your earlier question with regard to getting around the, you know, whatever efforts are made or technologies are created with regard to SOPA, we have a concern that if, in fact, you remove websites from the domain name system as it currently exists, that alternate or rogue DNS systems, and this gets very technical very quickly, but suffice to say that websites could go underground, as it were, creating additional enforcement issues. But clearly, this issue has some unusual and some typical battle lines. On one side, you do have the entertainment industry pushing this heavily, and there's plenty of evidence to show how that issue has come out. But on the business side, you have an interesting split. So you have companies like Google, like Yahoo on one side, and then you have entertainment industry companies on the other. You have the AFL-CIO, okay, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on the same side of the issue. So this is a very unusual political debate, but ultimately it boils down to a question of whether we want the Internet to be the free, open medium of communication that it is.
And I would say, yes, we do. I don't know that I want somebody arbitrarily shutting down websites and then going back and having to fight it down the road.
And that's ultimately what winds up happening. Invariably, I see that intellectual property litigation is expensive. It takes time. There are enormous costs associated, not just monetary, but in terms of resources that are put into fighting these things. And oftentimes you will have claims made of IP rights violations that have little or no merit, but the mere threat of litigation causes a party to retreat. And mm-hmm. we see this with entities like documentary filmmakers, and we see it with other entities where, again, the question becomes, do I have the resources? This bill goes far beyond what would be necessary.
You know, I go back to, and you know, I think about things in my own experience. And I remember as a kid, we used to steal music off the radio. We had a cassette player. We would record songs off the radio. I think it's kind of the same thing, just in a much better format digitally today. Are these industries really suffering? Are they not making profits? I guess that's a question that has to be answered as well.
Well, yeah, and that's always a raging debate. You know, how much is actually lost by the industry as a result of piracy? It's one of those questions where numbers are thrown around. Clearly, piracy exists. On the other hand, technology through things like iTunes has created an enormous market that didn't exist prior to literally the Internet for the entertainment industry to make quite a bit of money selling their content in a variety of formats. But the question, again, of whether piracy issue is a separate question from how this bill is written. And this bill is written in a way that, again, violates due process, that is a First Amendment violation, and creates enormous security issues for the Internet itself.
And it just seems to me, as you pointed out, kind of unnecessary, since there are already laws on the books.
The DMCA has been around for over 10 years. It has, and people may know it as through notice and takedown. And you see this on YouTube. You see it on any number of other sites where you had copyrighted works that were distributed. On a notice under the DMCA from IP rights holders saying, this is our IP, remove it, these providers are required to remove it. But the problem becomes this bill starts going against some of the basic speech protections that we have in the law, including Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which shields entities like YouTube, like Facebook, like Google, from being sued for linking to or sharing this kind of information. Now, there are ways to get around that, but primarily it turns into a question of whether the entity itself, like Google, is the speaker. Is the entity actually speaking, or whether they're merely distributing information? Section 230 is responsible, along with some other laws, but primarily 230, responsible for, literally, the flourishment of information sharing on the Internet. SOPA, Protect IP, would be a marked retreat from it.
So, again, you know, you would have, I think a chilling effect on free speech and thoughts and ideas, and one of the things I think that the Internet does very well.
Imagine a scenario where you have an innovator, right, someone trying to create a new technology, faced with the possibility of an IP rights holder saying that your technology might be used to infringe our copyright. And based upon that allegation, being removed from the Internet, are you going to innovate? That's at the core of this question and the problem with this bill.
Yep. And let's hope that we can fight this back. And as this pops up again in the future, I'd love to have you back on to keep us up to date on what's going on.
I would enjoy doing that. Hopefully I'll do it when I don't have a cold. So I appreciate you through my speech.
I hope you feel better, and I hope you have a fantastic holiday season.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. Dave Levine, assistant professor at Elon University School of Law. His piece, Don't Break the Internet. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on his name. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want the world.
The Rick Smith Show.
It's at this time of year that generous, big-hearted Americans reach out to aid the less fortunate among us, like those who've recently been knocked down by the recession and seen their incomes plummet. I speak, of course, about our nation's severely squeezed millionaires. Yes, many of the infamous 1% class are no longer feeling like $1 million. According to a new federal report, the income of these high-living swells averaged a robust $1.4 million in 2007. But after Wall Street crashed in a heap of greed late that year, their average income took a tumble. In 2009, it fell below the millionaire threshold, leaving these poor rich folks struggling to make it on an average income of only $957,000. Also, talk about getting a lump of coal in your Christmas stocking. The share of our nation's total income taken by the one percenters fell from a whopping 23% in 2007 to a mere 17% 2 years later. How sad for them, huh? The only balm for their little financial ouchie is that they are using it as a rebuke to the 99%ers of the Occupy Wall Street protests. See, say the rich, waving the federal report, our slice of the pie in 2009 was the smallest it's been in a decade, so your protest about inequality is out of date. Get a time machine, one front man for the Koch brothers barked at the Occupy movement. This is Jim Hightower saying, okay, but let's travel back only a few short years in time to 1980, when the top 1% was very happy to pocket a meager 10% of all of America's income. And by the way, today's 1%ers have had big income gains since 2009, while the 99% have lost income. So, the occupiers are right. The inequality is increasing.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith. Gotta find a way to hold the king out. Before they find a way to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us? Are you listening? No power without accountability.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So there's this guy. His name's Gary Johnson. Evidently, Gary is quitting the GOP race. Did you hear this? There's a guy named Gary Johnson. He was, I guess, he was running for president as a Republican. Did you hear about him? Because I really didn't. He wasn't on any of the debates. Hasn't really gotten much media coverage. The big multinational conglomerate media structure, they didn't really tell me about Gary Johnson. I know he was the former governor of New Mexico. I know he runs a lot. He did a couple of triathlons. He's a fitness nut. I know that. I guess he's kind of a peacenik. Well, anyway, he's now quit the race. He said, I've had enough. And now he's going to be a libertarian. So he's going to be running as the libertarian candidate. So I guess he's going from one group of people who don't know who he is to a group who nobody knows what it is. So do you think he's going to get any more traction than nothing? Because he really got nothing as the Republican candidate. I don't even know if you can call him a candidate because he was never allowed to really play with the other candidates.
Well, play with the other candidate. Well, before you totally write him off, Rick, I mean, there is some beginning talk of possibly trying to grab a third-party candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem is...
You know who's talking about third-party candidates?
Yeah.
Stupid people.
The Republicans who can't... Well, is that fair?
Yes.
There are probably some good candidates who are better than some of these nutbag conservatives, but the problem is you and I both know the system is stacked against the third party.
Yeah, so there's this guy. His name's Gary Johnson. He's now running for Libertarian. And again, I don't know who the Libertarian presidential candidate's going to be. Maybe they're going to have to primary. And that might be a good thing. Maybe a primary the Libertarian candidate. I don't know. But anyway, that's what he wants to do.
Let me ask you something. Would it or would it not be a huge help to the Republicans if you had a third party candidate that leaned Libertarian? I think that would take away more Republican votes than Democratic votes. I think that's a safe assumption. Or am I assuming something that isn't true?
You're hoping that something will happen like happened in 2000, where you had Nader, who ciphered some votes away from Gore. Is that what you're hoping for?
I would like to have the opposite effect.
But is that what you're hoping for on the other side?
I'm just thinking this through. I think if there was a Libertarian on the ballot as a national candidate, I think it would hurt the Republicans more than the Democrats. That's all I'm saying, right?
Oh, thank you for saying it. I'm envisioning this really big balloon. You ever see the kid who blows the big bubble? You know the kid who has a whole mouthful of chewing gum, blows this huge bubble, and then somebody comes and pops it with a pin.
Mm-hmm.
You are my pin.
I'm your pin.
Oh.
Well, let me ask you this.
It wasn't supposed to get into a hole.
Okay.
It was.
All I'm saying is, you know, in this country, a third party should be allowed to exist.
There you go. And then we have a situation where you have a president who is elected with 34% of the vote. Is that what we're looking for? So from the very beginning, two-thirds of the people already don't want him. See, now, if we're going to do that, I'm all in favor of third party, fourth party, whatever. But then you have to change the way we vote. You're going to have instant runoff voting so that the person with the majority of the votes wins.
And you have been an advocate of that for a long time.
For a very long time. And look, I would love to have third party, fourth parties. I would love to have people pushing the debate in our political structure. Not going to happen.
Look, some of these Republicans are, I wouldn't say they're as frustrated as we are, but they are frustrated with their party, and they are looking for an outlet for more reasonable positions. And are they looking for something that'll never happen? Perhaps. But I can't blame anybody that would make an effort to do that.
There you go. Well, I'm glad. Thank God you're here. Anyway, Newt Gingrich, his popularity fading in Iowa and across the nation. And, gee, I think the endorsement by AshleyMadison.com may have had just a touch to do with that, kind of pointing out exactly who he is. And that's the focus of the Borowitz report in a development that has hurt the front-runner status, the Republican presidential race here. Newt Gingrich has plunged in the polls as voters have begun, well, to remember who he is. Newt Gingrich had been surging in recent weeks, but according to pollster Davis Logsdon of the University of Minnesota's Opinion Research Institute, that was before people's memories of who Newt Gingrich is started to gradually kick in. And according to polls released today, Mr. Gingrich fared especially poorly amongst voters who agreed with the statement, wait a minute, that guy? He was an enormous... Well, you get it. Newt Gingrich has got to do something fast to keep people from remembering who he is, according to the pollster. He might try growing a mustache or wearing an eye patch, something along that lines, but I think it might be a little too late. On the ground in Iowa, Gingrich campaign strategists are working overtime to confront the challenge posed by voters remembering who he is, aides of the former Speaker of the House said today. According to one campaign source, the Gingrich campaign has begun seeking the support of people with mental disorders and other memory issues to make it hard for them to retain basic information. Problem is, most of those people, these source claims, are currently running for president. So there you go. Also, while Gingrich was in Iowa, don't know if you saw this, some guy walked up to him and called him the F word and the A word. Called him, you're a blank and blank. And he said, well, luckily it's a free country, and he walked away. But, I was looking at this guy going, wow. Has the party gotten that emboldened that they now remember who the guy is? They called him an a-hole. And I'm going, wow, that's pretty... It's not like Gingrich was going to drop the guy. But if he would have, had he turned to drop the guy, good right hook, taking him down, I would have voted for him. I absolutely would have.
Really?
Oh, I would have.
That's all it takes?
That's all it would have taken. Because I would have laughed. I mean, because to me, I got to be honest. As much as I dislike Newt Gingrich and I dislike a lot of these people, I would never be that disrespectful. And to me, at some point, we have to get that respect back. I may disagree with everything that you believe in, and I may think that you're a complete and total nitwit, but I'm not going to come right to your face and have that kind of confrontation. I guess maybe that's just my mother, smacking me a couple too many times, telling me to respect people.
You're talking civility.
Yeah, I mean, we may disagree, and I may think it, but I'm not going to come to your face and point my finger in your face, and just not going to do it.
Did you catch the interview that, it wasn't an interview, a gay man approached him and questioned him about his position on gay rights, and Newt actually told him, he said, well, then you need to vote for Barack Obama.
And what's wrong with that?
I'm surprised he said it. I thought he'd try to give him some BS position.
Why?
Why? I mean, come on, Newt. Newt would try to persuade the devil that he needed a fur coat. Come on, let's be honest. The Newt's been around so long, I think Newt is so arrogant that he thinks he can win any argument.
Well, he's not going to win this election. People are remembering who he is, and... Well, he's got a lot of baggage, and even the Republicans are trying to, I think I go back to 2008, and when you go back and you kind of look at how things transpired and how the Democratic Party really walked away from John Edwards, you remember that there was a point at which they were really pushing him away as a party, because I think they knew what was coming, and they quietly tried to get him out, because if he were to have gotten the nomination... Mm. And that whole thing about him cheating on his wife with her with breast cancer and all that would have come out. He'd have lost, without question. In fact, I think they would have probably dumped him and gotten another candidate, out of the stands. Somebody. And I think Newt's the same way. I think the people who are pulling the strings in all this, the people who are orchestrating this whole play, they put him out there, hey, let's let him go up. It's a horse race. But ultimately, he doesn't stand a chance. And I think he knows that. I think he's smart enough to play the game, sell his crummy books, benefit where you can. Like, he sold his own campaign, his email list, made about 47 grand there. He's got his book. He's going to be just fine. He's going to keep Calista in the finest of Tiffany jewelry. He's going to make sure that the credit card doesn't go above $1 million. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it. And I saw this thing today. Someone sent me this. We talk about royalty. You know, you look over in Europe and you talk about the royal family. You talk about kings and queens and stuff. And they go, you know, we have our own royalty in this country. Ancestry.com did a looking back. And they've come up with Mitt Romney is the 10th cousin twice removed to George W. Bush. Actually, Huntsman is also related to the both of them. So, I mean, it's just this whole, and they go through how, you know, how they're related. And it's pretty amazing that these handful of people who keep popping up somehow seem to all be interrelated. It's kind of amazing. So we've got our own type of royal family here. It's the moneyed family. The people who have the money to keep pushing their kids into this stuff.
I do believe that, if you've heard, and I do believe them. Heard stories of George Bush and how several years before the year 2000 election, they were literally, you know, the powerful and the elite got together and they were sitting around the table and saying, well, who's available? And it dawned on somebody, you know, George Bush is available.
There
now,
you go.
Was he the best? Was he the best qualified? I'm sure he wasn't, but... two-term president, amazingly.
Well, there you go.
He came from the right pedigree. That certainly helped.
Well, all right. Well, let's look at the latest Texas governor running for president. And, you know, how harmful could a Texas governor be? You know, how bad could things be with another Texas governor? Rick Perry was out on the stump, and yesterday he added another gaffe to his long list of things that either fell out of his mouth or didn't. In fact... You know, he's talking about his big plan. I'm going to have this plan. See, what we're going to do is we're going to have a 20% flat personal income tax. See, and we're going to treat them all deduction stuff. You know, and he's talking. He's going. You know, we're going to have standard deductions of people. And you know, and he's reaching. He's trying to find it. You know, he's I know it's there somewhere. It's kind of like I got three things. You know, So Bobby Jingle Jangle Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, had to actually jump in and tell him that the standard deduction per person in the household was $12,500. And I love his response. He goes, thank you for correcting me on that. Not that I've ever made a mistake. And I go, you know, what a doofus. Is this the guy we really want for president? And I sure hope the answer is no. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, right after this. Stick around.
Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking time off to spend with our families, hoping you the best holiday season possible. We'll see you back here live next year. Happy holidays.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So, I got to be honest. You know, I used to think and I used to think the Republicans strategically, they were far superior, but they're really testing my belief in them. I mean, this whole thing with this payroll tax break defies logic. Just defies logic. And after what they pulled today, amazing stuff. Anyway, here to talk more about that and what else is going on around D.C. and around the world, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
You know, I look at this and I go, are they just dumb? Just lick your wounds and pass the two-month extension and let it go.
Well, that's exactly what Karl Rove said.
Wow, hold on.
I know, you went a bit quiet there, didn't you? That's what he said.
I agree with Karl Rove on something. I mean, just from a political standpoint, you go, you're taking your lumps over this, you're on the wrong side of this in every conceivable way. As someone who wants them to lose, I'm saying double down. You know, bet the house on this.
Yeah, no, this is what Rove is saying. Look, you know, half the thing. Well, actually, he's saying wait till Obama goes to Hawaii, wait till everybody goes home, pass the thing, and then blame them. But he's basically saying you've backed yourself into a corner. You've got to pass it. And that's really the fact of the matter. They've got to pass it. They really have no choice because nobody's going to appoint anybody to this so-called conference committee. It's not happening.
Right. So let me ask you this. Why gamble out until Friday? You know, I watched the whole debacle where they walked out. The Democrats want to talk about it. They say, nope, we're adjourning till Friday.
Because it's a pro forma session, because they're in recess. Uh-huh. And they have to hold the pro forma sessions every few days. They have to do it every 2 or 3 days. So that's when the next pro forma session has to be.
Okay. I just thought they were just, at that point I'm watching this, I'm going, I have no idea why you're doing this.
Yeah, no, it's procedure.
Ah, procedure. But they still could have stood there and talked about it, no?
Yes, procedure.
They could have voted on it. I seem to remember during the Bush years, the Bushies used to go up or down vote, up or down vote. And I don't hear that much anymore from the Republicans.
No, not on this particular issue. You might hear it on other issues. I mean, you know, up or down vote suits people sometimes on some issues. But right now, up or down vote is not the way to go. Right now, it's, no, we're going to conference because that's the natural order of things.
Yeah, well, okay. And then order a study on it. So we can delay it even longer. Let me ask you this. I mean, the general feeling you're getting there, is it possible that they're going to let this thing expire?
Yes, that's a possibility. That's considered to be one of the possibilities. I mean, one of the possibilities is that somebody will pay. The other possibility is that they will let this expire. It's considered unlikely because nobody wants to get blamed, but it is considered an actual possibility that it could happen. But at this point, it's thought that the Republicans are looking around and actually going, oh, we might get blamed for this.
No, not might. You're blamed for it. We're already there.
John Boehner realizes that, and Mitch McConnell realizes that, and even Eric Cantor realizes that. It's the rank and file Tea Party Republicans who don't realize that.
Yeah, you know, I look at Boehner, and you know he's got to be depressed. Because, you know, I think he truly wanted to be the Tom DeLay. He wanted to be the hammer. He wanted to be the guy in charge. And he is being ripped and twisted and pulled and bent over every time you turn around.
Yes. Yes, he is.
And good for him. Everyone needs some loving, I guess. Anyway, I guess some new rules coming out from the EPA, the job-killing organization of America, as Michelle Bachmann would say.
Yes, they brought the rules out today, highly anticipated national standards to limit power plants' output of mercury and other toxic air pollutants that have been linked to developmental disorders and childhood asthma. Now, this is really very interesting. These long-delayed standards have been the subject of a ferocious lobbying and public relations battle, and the Republicans have been very angry about this. They say the rules will harm the economy, force the closure of coal-fired power plants, and threaten the reliability of the country's power grid. In other words, there are going to be massive outages as a result of this. Well, the EPA says today that, nope, these regulations, which require coal and oil-fired power plants to install technology to reduce harmful air pollutants, will offer massive public health benefits to and limited costs to industry.
Yeah, I got to be honest. This is part of the reason that I'm in favor of the federal government paying for health care, because you know you look at the numbers out there. I think I saw something like 17,000-18,000 premature deaths a year, something like 11,000 heart attacks, a couple hundred thousand or 200,000 people suffering from asthma because of this, and the health costs that are associated with this, somebody's paying. So for me, I want that to be in the equation when you start looking at the true cost of things.
Well, and I think this is exactly what the government would say, what the Obama administration would say, and certainly what the EPA would say. I mean, they've got stats on, you know, the numbers of people who they say will be will be helped by this. I mean, the thousands and thousands of people who will have illnesses prevented as a result of these regulations being in place. Nevertheless, it's been extremely controversial.
Yeah, but only 17,000 people a year killed because of it. You know, the other part of me goes, well, that's only 17,000. We can afford that, right?
Well,
didn't the herd?
Them.
As long as I'm not one of them?
Yes, I think if you ask them, they might feel differently.
No, but I mean, the sad reality is that that plays into some people's calculus. I'm thinking 17,000 people. Holy, we should probably be going to wind and solar and tidal and geothermal and all those alternative things. Maybe we should be investing in that. Or maybe not. Or maybe not. Maybe we should be just spending more money in Iraq.
Well, we're not, because we've left Iraq, and so we've left Iraq to the Iraqis, and they have decided that, they've got all kinds of things going on, actually, including a bit of a mess.
Uh-oh.
Well, the mess started before we left, and the mess, as it stands now, is that Iraq's Prime Minister, who's a Shiite, al-Maliki, has issued an arrest warrant for the Vice President, al-Hashimi, who is a Sunni, on terrorism charges, that he had these death squads that were sent around to assassinate political people. Al-Hashimi says that's totally untrue, and the confessions that were seen on TV are bogus and made up. And by the way, you should know that these two people are old, old political rivals, besides being Sunni and Shiite. So al-Hashimi fled to the semi-autonomous Kurdish region, which puts him out of reach. So al-Maliki said, hey, Kurds, we want you to extradite him. We want him back. Meantime, al-Hashimi's party, Iraqia, has boycotted the Iraqi parliament. And al-Maliki has said, oh, no, you don't. I'll sort you out. And so he's called for talks. But he added, if the talks don't work, what I'm thinking of doing is I'm moving to form a majority government. And that would, in essence, preclude Sunnis from being involved in power.
Nice. So we leave and Saddam Jr. takes over.
Well, sort of in a sort of opposite way. And it's kind of messy. Yeah.
Now,
this could all work itself out because this is how things roll in Iraq.
Right.
Now, this is sort of like, Tuesday afternoon, how things are. So it could all just calm down.
Well,
I'm in a busy place.
Yeah, we shall see.
Or it could all explode.
We shall see. I saw a report that we may have troops. We got the troops out of Iraq. Now they're talking about Afghanistan past 2014.
Yeah, there was an interview with General John Allen in the New York Times, and he indicated that certainly Hamid Karzai has been saying that he's interested in talking about having troops stay beyond 2014, because Hamid Karzai might say that one day and then say the opposite the next day. That's one thing to bear in mind. Jay Carney said today at the White House press briefing room that any staying beyond 2014 would be at the invitation of the Iraqi government, and that we are on track. In fact, we've met our goal this year for drawing down our troops, and we continue to draw down.
Good. All I got to say is good. Bye. And lastly, it is the holiday season, and tonight is our last show of the year. Going to be taking off for the big holiday. And again, you got to love the Christmas spirit. The war on Christmas rages on, according to the Republicans. In fact, I've had a number of people give me some very angry Merry Christmas when I say Happy Holidays to them. But I saw a story, somebody stealing baby Jesus's. Tell me it's not true.
It's true. It's true in Virginia. And they started in Fredericksburg, and they swiped one. I believe it was from a shopping center, nativity scene. And then they swiped one from Spotsylvania. And then a couple more were nabbed over the weekend. And then another one was pilfered. Now, one of them has shown up on Facebook. And the police were tipped off, and they raided a woman's home and found it. But the others remain
in a mystery. It's an absolute mystery. They raided this woman's house.
Well,
over...
they went to the woman's house. They didn't raid. I exaggerated the story for effect. when some politely knocked on her door.
It was good. I thought they were kicking in the doors with guns drawn.
Yeah, no, I think they politely knocked on her door and said, excuse me, Mrs. Jenkins, do you have a baby Jesus? Could we have a look, please?
And you know what's amazing to me? That seems to be a national story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just priorities. Anyway, Victoria, it's been a great year. I want to thank you for all the time you've given us over the year. You've been fantastic. We look forward to next year, and I hope you have a wonderful, safe, happy holiday and just a fantastic new year here.
Thank you, you too. I look forward to talking to you in 2012, yes. Election year.
Yay. Victoria Yay. Jones, thanks so much. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. And we're right back to wrap this thing up.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now. Until the end.
Mind-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So today, Romney was being interviewed by MSNBC's Chuck Todd, and I got to play this clip because it's just one of those things where you go, what exactly are you talking about?
If we knew at the time of our entry into Iraq that there were no weapons of mass destruction, if somehow we had been given that information, why obviously we would not have gone in.
You don't think we would have gone in?
Well, of course not. The president went in based upon intelligence that they had weapons of mass destruction. Had he known that that was not the case, the UN would not have put forward resolutions authorizing this type of action. The president would not have been pursuing that course. But we did not know that based upon what we knew. At the time, we were very much under the impression as a nation, that our president was under the impression that they had weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was intent on potentially using those weapons, and so he took action based upon what he knew. But to go back and say, well, knowing what we know now, would we have gone in? Well, knowing what we know now, they did not have weapons of mass destruction. There would have been no effort on the part of our president or others to take military action.
Ah. See, but here's the thing. There are a lot of people out there saying that Bush knew. George Tenet briefed Bush on it, said nothing. Suskind said, look, Bush was informed in early 2003. A couple of CIA agents said, look, He was told nothing. And you go back to the whole thing with Mickey Herskowitz.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
And that's what he did. He said that in 1999. They were planning this from day one. So this disingenuous, oh, well, you know, what we knew at the time what we were doing. Simple stuff. Anyway, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Thanks, Rick. Yesterday, New York, Nurses Association had a protest about Cerber Stewart. Cerber Stewart has entered into the healthcare industry. It operates about 10 hospitals in Massachusetts, and it's partnered with a number of physician practices in New York City. It is entering the health insurance market as well. Cerber Stewart has come under increasing criticism for cornering the market with predatory practices, including undercutting patient care with its push for profits. Where have we heard this before? Nurses who work at the hospital say that Cerber Stewart has failed to maintain quality health care standards in contravention of an agreement reached with the state and with its employees before it was allowed to take control of the formerly non-profit facilities. The approval of the profit makers' takeover is tied to keeping patient care a top priority. According to the National Nurses United Union, it says the company makes daily threats to close services or entire hospitals in direct violation of its assurances to the state as a condition of entering the marketplace. Worse than that, nurses report that a number of alarming changes since Cerber Stewart took over. Staffing levels have been reduced. Specialty units, believe it or not, specialty units for the care of specific conditions have been totally eliminated, and patients are treated like products on an assembly line. Even the most basic supplies are not available when nurses need them. For example, bread, crackers, and juice, which nurses need to stabilize diabetic patients. Services really is a cutthroat private equity firm whose chief objective is to maximize profits, not to provide good health care to its patients and communities. Nurses Association, like the National Nurses United, have been sounding the alarm, and rightfully so. And unfortunately, you see more and more and more of this kind of thing in the healthcare industry. And it's a disgrace when you have a company, and this company is apparently one of the worst, would blatantly put the health and welfare of its patients at risk. It's unconscionable, and I think something needs to be done. I think eventually something will be done, but hopefully not too many people are going to have to pay the price. NLRB election rule is going to take effect on April 30th. It's a new rule on the way that have oversight with union elections and how they're being conducted. That'll take effect on the 30th of April. The National Labor Relations Board will oversee that. The rule will help alleviate the delays and efficiencies of Bruce process and unnecessary litigation, which plagued the current system for workers who want to vote or whether to have a union. The new rule, according to NLRB Chairman Mark Gatson, gives workers who have petitioned for the election the right to vote in a timely manner and without the impediment of needless litigation. To fight these new union election rules, Republican congressmen have made nearly 50 separate assaults in the NLRB since January by holding meetings, issuing subpoenas, proposing bills to gut the agency's funding and eliminate its ability to hold employees accountable for violating workers' rights, according to American Rights at Work. In the end, the Republicans failed to stop the new rules, which will ensure a fair and just election process, finally, and kudos to the Dems for being tough on that issue. Back to you, Rick.
All righty. Well, it is the last program of the year. We are taking time off to spend a little time with our families. Hope that you'll be able to do the same. Hoping that everyone's going to have a healthy, happy holiday season. I know my kids thrilled to death that Santa will soon be coming. And that's what this time of the year is really about for me anyway. I mean, as I'm getting older, it's no longer about what am I going to get. It's that expression in the morning. I think it's all parents see that as their kids come running down and that happy, joyous time that the fortunate among us get to enjoy. I would also hope that folks would take a moment, not just this time of the year, but year round, to remember those who maybe are not as lucky. Do something nice this holiday season, help someone else out. My wife was looking for one of those trees, and a couple people sent emails saying, "Hey, you might want to check here, you might want to check there." Evidently, they're not doing the tree anymore, where they put people's names on it, and you go buy whatever present they want. I don't know the reason why they aren't doing it, but it was something my family liked to do. Because my wife would pick one for each of the three kids, and the kids would go and then, go to the store and have that experience of buying it specifically for someone. Because I do think charity is something that you learn. I think it is a process of learning the joy of giving. And, hopefully my kids remember that. It's not just about giving and it's not just about getting, it's about giving as well. So I'm hoping this holiday season everybody has a happy, joyous time. We're going to, again, take the week off, spend a little time with our families. We spend a lot of time here. But, again, if you want to email us, rick@therickSmithShow.com, best way to get a hold of me during the week. I'm still going to be checking my email, still going to be doing a little of this and that, but I'm going to spend time with family. That's what this is about. For too long it's been about, commercialism. It's about buying, go to the stores, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, I Surrender Sunday, Cyber Monday, just bombed out of my mind Tuesday. What it's really about is it's about the people that you love and that you hold dear and being part of a community. And I think too often during this time of year, we seem to forget that. And hopefully everyone has a good holiday.
And I also think it's a time of year we reflect on your life. And I think all of us, although we all have our trials and tribulations, there's a lot that we can be thankful for. And there's a lot of people less fortunate than us. And I think that's what's important. And I think all of us, if we've been blessed, and I know I've been blessed, thank God of my union and thank God I had good health all my life. There's a lot of people out there that weren't as lucky as I was. And I hope we can, whenever we have the opportunity, we can help those people.
So what do you want Santa to bring you for the holiday?
Really?
Yeah, what's are you getting coal under your stocking? Because I think coal is what you deserve.
Well, fortunately for me, you are not the final arbiter. What do I really want? Honestly, Rick, you're going to say I don't believe you, but I haven't thought about it. Whatever I get is fine. I'm like you. I'm at the time of life where it's not really what I receive as a Christmas present. It's really the joys of the season, and I think the older I get, the more I realize that is true.
Okay, so if you get syphilis, you'll just be happy, thankful to the person
you gave it to. I can't believe
you said
that.
Is that what you're telling me?
No.
I don't really care what I get.
Within reason. You know what I'm talking about as a gift, right?
Yeah. Just trying to, like I told my wife, what I want, I can't have. The things that I want, I cannot have. I want more time. I want there to be longer time in the day. I want there to be broad prosperity. I want workers' rights. I want so many things that are much more difficult to achieve than just wrapping something up in a box that you bought at the store. Because this holiday has really done a masterful job of helping the economy in China. Because we've run out to the stores and we've bought all of this stuff made elsewhere. So I guess one of my things that I would like to see in the new year is for us to think more about how do we support our neighbors? How do we support our community? That would be a good start for me. And we're looking forward to some time off. I think I'm going to take the kids snow tubing. I'm hoping that the resorts have been able to make a little ice and we can go shooting down the hill in the tube.
I believe you had a fairly bad experience with that, didn't you, before?
No, not me.
No, you. Oh, I thought you hit somebody with that.
Oh, yeah, well, I hit somebody. That was a bad experience for me. It's a bad experience for them.
Well, it could have been.
They were walking where they shouldn't have been, and down came this rocket and took them right out.
That is fun. I remember as a kid, we used to go tobogganing with four or five people on a toboggan at night. Oh, those are great memories.
Yeah, but anyway, I wish you, your family, everybody a happy, safe holiday. And we will see you back here next year. And it's kind of hard to say, it's kind of weird to say 2012 is going to be an amazing year. To me, it's going to be the year that really dictates the direction of this country. And we're all going to have to stick together. We're going to all have to stand and fight together. But before that starts, let us celebrate this holiday and enjoy our families. Have a great evening, and we will see you in the new year.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the Buddha's sway.